evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, August 29, 2016. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you are listening in over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our caller number is 605-562-3140, and our participant code is 385-698. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send questions to questions, that's plural, questions at nationallibertyalliance.org. Again, that's questions, plural, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support National Liberty Alliance by donating $5 a month or more. Please click on our donation tab up on the top right-hand side, which, by the way, I'm working out a credit card thing with my bank finally. It took a while to get that through, and hopefully that's going to be up this week. They're supposed to be helping me set it up this week, so if that happens, there'll be another alternative than PayPal, and also our store will be able to open up, which we got some items up there for sale already, but there's a lot of them that are not ready yet for sale yet. Okay. All right. Tonight's scripture reading is going to be 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 1 through 13. That's 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 1 through 13. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I am become as a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understanding all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I can remove mountains, and have not charity, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. Charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not, charity vaunteth not itself, and is not puffed up. Doeth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, nor but rejoiceth in the truth, beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Charity never faileth, but whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know, even as also I am known. And now abideth faith, hope, and charity. These three, but the greatest of these is charity. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 1 through 13. Okay, tonight we're going to look a little bit at the courts. We're going to talk a little bit about jurisdiction. I've got a paper that we're going to read. You can get a copy of this paper up on our website at nationallibertyalliance.org. Click on the grand jury blue label there on the far right side, and you can come down and you can get this memorandum of jurisdiction. Okay, this, by the way, was submitted into the courts out there in Oregon on the 22nd. So they received it last Thursday, and I believe they're mulling it over. But we're going to read this, and I also posted this also up. If you go up to the grand jury, highlight grand jury, and you click on memorandums of law, all memorandums that we write, we're going to be writing quite a few of them. We have some written already that we want to go through and clean up and put in a proper format, exactly the way we have this format. And then we'll be posting them here, too, for the purpose of education, to understand jurisdiction, to understand nullification, to understand the power and the authority of the jury and the grand jury to understand, you know, what is a court of record, what is Article III courts. You know, we're going to do memorandums on all of these issues, due process, the right of due process, and habeas corpus. We'll do memorandums on all of these things. And these are key issues. So when you go into the courts and you want to make your points, you want to establish certain things, and you can use these memorandums. And, of course, you could do with them as you please. You can tweak them one way or the other. But the key thing, of course, is making your point in your own case however best you can, and making sure the proper jurisdiction is, you know, that you're in the proper jurisdiction. And that's your first battle. It's an uphill battle. It's hard to maintain and keep because these people just are that evil. And every day I see more and more darkness. I want to tell you the evil of these people, the extent that they will go to, and there is nothing beyond these people. Nothing that they would not do in order to have their way. Okay, anyway, memorandum of law in support of jurisdiction. I'm just going to read through this and we'll talk just a few minutes on it and we'll move on. First, memorandum of law in support of jurisdiction. Authority. What is the authority? That's the first question. Authority. The unalienable right of the sovereign people to self-governance was ordained by God, established in the Declaration of Independence, and ordained by we the people, who are the authority of all law. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of us, the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Any servant who resists these truths, war against the governor of the universe, and wars against we the people. Sovereignty itself is, of course, not subject to law, for it is the author and source of law. But in our system, while sovereign powers are delegated to the agencies of government, sovereignty itself remains with the people, by whom and for whom all government exists and acts. And the law is the definition and limitation of power. Yicks versus Hopkins. We, the sovereign people of the United States of America, on March 4th, 1789, birthed a nation. In order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, ordained and established this Constitution for the United States of America. Obviously, that's from the preamble. We the people ordained through Article 3, Section 1, thereby creating one Supreme Court with vested judicial powers, and also ordained Congress with the power to ordain and establish inferior courts with the same vested judicial powers. 28 U.S. Code 132, creation and composition of district courts. There shall be in each judicial district a district court, which shall be a court of record, known as the United States District Court for the district. Each district court shall consist of the district judge or judges for the district in regular active services. Justices or judges designated or assigned shall be competent to sit as judges of the court, except as otherwise provided by law or rule or other or order of court. The judicial power of a district court with respect to any action, suit, or proceeding may be exercised by a single judge, who may preside alone and hold a regular or special session of court at the same time other sessions are held by other judges. In Article 6, Clause 2, we the people establish that judges may hold their office only during good behavior, which we defined in Article 6, Clause 2, thereby binding their behavior by the supreme law of the land. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made pursuant thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. Failure of good behavior by a judge requires his removal from office. Congress is a creature of law with clipped authority. In the unauthorized creation by the 41st Congress, who acted without constitutional authority, an act of fraud, conspiracy, and subversion against the United States of America, only the people can ordain and establish laws and governments. Only the people are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights. Governments are not. Consequently, in congruence with Marbury versus Madison, all latter construction upon the Organic Act of 1871 is null and void, as is the Act itself. Said Act attempted to supplant our Republican form of government that our servants were entrusted to guarantee, criminally creating a foreign venue, sovereign state, proceeding under the fiction of law. Any court resting upon said Act is a de facto court. Any judge acting under such fiction of law denies due process and is acting in excess of their judicial authority in collusion under color of law, thereby losing judicial immunity. Therefore, any judicial reliance upon said act is injudicious. Courts that resist the Constitution. It will be an evil day for American liberty if the theory of government outside supreme law finds lodgment in our constitutional jurisprudence. No higher duty rests upon this court than to exert its full authority to prevent all violations of the principles of the Constitution. Downs versus Bidwell. A law repugnant to the Constitution is void. If then the courts are to regard the Constitution and the Constitution as superior to any ordinary act of the legislature, the Constitution and not such ordinary act must govern the case to which they both apply. Those then who resist the principle that the Constitution is to be considered in court as a paramount law are reduced to the necessity of maintaining that courts must close their eyes on the Constitution and see only the law. This doctrine would subvert the very foundation of all written constitutions. It would declare that an act which, according to the principles and theories of our government, is entirely void, is yet in practice completely obligatory. It would declare that if the legislature shall do what is expressly forbidden, such act, notwithstanding the express prohibition, is in reality effectual. It would be given to the legislature a practical and real omnipotent, with the same breath which professes to restrict their powers with narrow limits. It is prescribing limits and declaring that those limits may be passed at pleasure. Thus, the particular phraseology of the Constitution of the United States confirms and strengthens the principle, supposed to be essential to all written constitution, that a law repugnant to the Constitution is void and that courts as well as other departments are bound by that instrument. Marbury versus Madison. When an oath becomes equally a crime, it is in these words, I do solemnly swear, and I will administer justice without respect to persons, and do equal right to the poor and to the rich, and that I will faithfully and impartially discharge all the duties incumbent on me, as according to the best of my abilities and understanding, agreeably to the Constitution and the laws of the United States. Why does a judge swear to discharge his duties agreeably to the Constitution of the United States if that Constitution forms no rule for his government, if it is closed upon him and cannot be inspected by him? If such be the real state of things, this is worse than solemn mockery. To prescribe or to take this oath becomes equally a crime. Again, Marbury versus Madison. Where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there could be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. Miranda versus Arizona. No judicial process whatsoever from it may assume can have any lawful authority outside of the limits of the jurisdictions of the court or judge by whom it is issued, and an attempt to enforce it beyond these boundaries is nothing less than lawless violence. Abelman versus Booth. We judges have no more right to decline the exercise of jurisdiction which is given than to usurp that which is not given. The one or the other would be treason to the Constitution. Cohen versus Virginia. That statute, which would deprive a citizen of the rights of the persons or property without a regular trial according to the course and usage of common law, would not be the law of the land. Hoke versus Henderson. We the people are the sovereign. Plaintiffs are free and independent sovereign people with the unalienable right of due process, with no contract with any administrative or foreign court, and thereby owing the state nothing and under no obligation that would require the plaintiff to seek leave from any servant who has no jurisdiction or authority over the plaintiffs. We are not subjects of the state, but the masters thereof. It is the public policy of this state that public agencies exist to aid in the conduct of the people's business. The people of this state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them. At the revolution, the sovereignty devoted to on the people, and they are truly the sovereigns of the country. But they are sovereigns without subjects, with none to govern but themselves. Chisholm versus Georgia. The very meaning of the word sovereignty is that the decree of the sovereign makes the law. American Banana Company versus United Fruit Company. Sovereignty itself is, of course, not subject to law, for it is the author and the source of law. But in our system, while sovereign powers are delegated to the agencies of government, sovereignty itself remains the people by whom and for whom all government exists and acts, and the law is defined and limitation of power. Yickwo versus Hopkins. I think we repeated that one. I'm going to make a note on that. Under federal law, which is applicable to all states, the U.S. Supreme Court stated that if a court is without authority, its judgment and orders are regarded as nullities. They are not voidable, but simply void, and form no bar to recovery sought, even prior to a reversal in opposition to them. They constitute no justification, and all persons concerned in executing such judgment or sentences are considered in the law as trespassers. Basco versus UPL. A court of record is a judicial tribunal having the attributes and exercising functions independently of the person of the magistrate designed generally to hold it, and proceeding according to the course of the common law, its acts and proceedings being enrolled for a perpetual memorial. Jones versus Jones. Decisions of an inferior court are subject to collateral attacks. In other words, in a superior court, one may sue an inferior court directly rather than resort to appeal to an appellate court. Decisions of a court of record may not be appealed. It is binding on all other courts. However, no statutory or constitutional court, whether it be an appellate or Supreme Court, can second-guess the judgments of a court of record. The judgment of a court of record, by the way, a court of record ultimately is a court that has a jury. A court of record whose jurisdiction is final is as conclusive on all the world as the judgment of this court would be. And this is the United States Supreme Court speaking. It is as conclusive on this court as it is on other courts. It puts an end to inquiry concerning the facts deciding it. Ex parte Watkins, 3 Peter, and also Sincloth versus Bustamante. A court of record is a superior court. A court not of record is an inferior court. Inferior courts are those whose jurisdiction is limited and special and whose proceedings are not according to the course of the common law. Criminal courts proceed according to the statutory law. Jurisdiction and procedure is defined by statute. Likewise, civil courts and admiralty courts proceed according to the statutory law. Any court proceeding according to the statutory court is not a court of record. It is an inferior court. The only intent different ordinarily recognized between superior and inferior courts is that there is a presumption in favor of the validity of the judgments of the former, none in favor of those of the latter, and that a superior court may be shown not to have had power to render a particular judgment by reference to its record. Note, however, that a superior court is the name of a particular court. But when a court acts by virtue of a special statute conferring jurisdiction in a certain class or of cases, it is a court of inferior or limited jurisdiction, for the time being, no matter what its ordinary status may be. The common law. Unalienable rights are the spirit of common law, the law of our Creator and not man. All laws to be understood in light of our unalienable rights. Any law repugnant to that spirit is by nature, nature's creator, null and void. The Declaration of Independence being the foundation of American law upon which was framed the law of the land, also known as the Constitution for the United States of America. Article 6 and its capstone, Bill of Rights, which is the crown of our law, are all common law documents that were constructed upon common law principles. To deny common law is to deny these documents. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, Declaration of Independence. Amendment 7, in suits of common law, where the value of the controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury, that's a court of record, shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. Synopsis of rule of law. The Supreme Court has the implied power from the United States Constitution to review acts of Congress and to declare them void if they are found to be repugnant to the Constitution. Marbury v. Madison. All cases which have cited Marbury v. Madison cases to the Supreme Court has never been overturned. See Shepard's citation of Marbury v. Madison. This brings us to the second inquiry, which is, if he has a right and that right has been violated, do the laws of his country afford him a remedy? The very essence of civil liberty certainly consists in the right of every individual to claim the protection of the laws whenever he receives an injury. One of the first duties of government is to afford that protection. In Great Britain, the king himself is sued in the respectful form of a petition, and he never fails to comply with the judgment of his court. In the third volume of his commentaries, page 23, Blackstone stated two cases in which a remedy is afforded by mere operation of law. In all of the cases, he said, it is a general and indisputable rule, that where there is a legal right, there is also a legal remedy by suit or action at law whenever that right is invaded. And afterwards, page 109 of the same volume, he says, I am next to consider such injuries as are cognizable by the court of common law, and herein I shall for the present only remark that all possible injuries, whatsoever, that did not fall within the exclusive cognizance of either the ecclesiastical, military, or maritime tribunals are for that very reason within the cognizance of the common law courts of justice. For it is a settled and invariable principle in the laws of England that every right, when withheld, must have a remedy, and every injury its proper redress. The government of the United States has been empathetically termed a government of laws and not of men. It will certainly cease to deserve this high appellation if the laws furnish no remedy for the violation of a vested legal right. If this obloque is to be cast on the jurisprudence of our country, it must arise from a particular character of the case. It behooves us, then, to inquire whether there be its composition any ingredient which shall exempt from legal investigation or exclude the injured party from legal redress. In pursuing this inquiry, the first question which presents itself is whether there can be arranged with that class of cases which can, under the description of Not sure how to pronounce this. Dunum obscura injuria. Anyway, however that's pronounced, a loss, which means a loss without an injury. If any statement within any law which is passed is unconstitutional, the whole law is unconstitutional. Marbury versus Madison. That statute which would deprive a citizen of the rights of persons or property without, would not be the law of the land. Hoke versus Henderson. Where common law rights, as a matter of fact, I think that's also a duplicated quote. I'm going to put a mark next to that, too. Where common rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. Again, Miranda versus Arizona. And again, I think that's duplicated. I think I read that a few minutes ago. The Court of Appeal rule would neither preserve nor enhance the traditional functioning of a grand jury that the common law of the Fifth Amendment demands. That's the United States versus Williams. If a federal town be necessary for the residence of Congress and the public offices, it ought to be a small one, and the government of a fixed and a government of it fixed on Republican and common law principles, carefully enumerated and established by the Constitution. It is true the states, when they shall cede places, may stipulate that the laws and governance of the Congress in them shall always be formed in such principles. Anti-Federalists, number 41 through 43, part 2. You know, it appears here, just looking back at this here, because we do have that problem with the Organic Act, which created that state within a, inside a state, inside of a municipality. Or let me think about that. Well, a municipality of the city and then created a state with inside the municipality. And that, of course, created a problem, and they left common law altogether. And so our founding fathers, they were aware of this problem, but they didn't seem to have solved it, I don't think. Maybe they have, but I'm not aware of it. But this has been our major problem that we're really battling here, which is what the 41st Congress had done with the Organic Act. Anyway, the 41st paragraph of the New York State Constitution provides that the trial by jury remain invalid forever, and that no acts of attainder shall be passed by the legislature of this state for crimes other than those committed before the termination of the present war, and that the legislature should at no time hereinafter institute any new courts but such as shall proceed according to the course of the common law. No legislation in conflict with the common law is of any validity. And again, that was Anti-Federalist paper number 45. The common law is sometimes called by the way of eminence lex tori, as in the statute of the Magna Carta, chapter 29, where certainly the common law is principally intended by those words. And again, I can't pronounce these words, so I'll skip it, by the exposition thereof in several subsequent statutes. This common law, or law of the land, the king was sworn to maintain. This fact is recognized by a statute made at Westminster in 1346 by Edward III, which commences in this manner, trial by jury by Lysander Spooner. The law requires proof of jurisdiction to appear on the record of the administrative agency and all administrative proceedings. And it's found in Higgins versus Levine. And you know, I've been researching that. And really, the bottom line on this, if there is no jurisdiction to appear on the record, then it has to be common law, because the law requires anything outside of a court of record or trial by jury, a court of record, it has to have the jurisdiction. So it has to be written, whatever kind of an administrative court. It refers to administrative courts, courts, statutory courts, ultimately, is the point. Okay, conclusion. All Article III courts are courts of record and are to proceed under the rules of the common law. Common law is nature's law ordained by God. Constitutions are an inalienable right ordained by the sovereign people. Legislators are bound by the change of the Constitution and have no authority to create governments or write laws outside of these bonds. if no jurisdiction appears on the proceedings, it must be a court of record. Any judge resting in fiction of law that proceeds under the color of law loses all immunity. Decisions of such an inferior court are subject to collateral attack. In other words, in a superior court, one may sue the inferior court directly rather than resort to appeal to an appellate court. And I've been looking into that. I haven't found too much on that, but it is pretty clear that a superior court may sue an inferior court directly instead of going to an appeal. And so that's a very interesting point that we need to really look further into. I know I am. Okay, that brings us to the end of this memorandum. I'm going to go out and pull those repeats. There must have been about four of them throughout this paper. And then I'll repost it. But anyway, that is a memorandum of jurisdiction in support of memorandum of law in support of jurisdiction. And the key thing in a court is you want to be in a court of record. That is the key. And that's trial by jury, ultimately. And it cannot be a puppet jury. And we're going to talk about those things in the near future. We're going to be looking to write a paper on that. You know, the way that they choose these juries, and we've really been watching what they've been doing out there in Oregon and the choosing of the juries. And I do have a paper here from New York, which is a questionnaire, which blew my mind. I think I may post that up there. And it seems that most of the states have pretty much a similar paper, but they sometimes or often will design that paper question, the questions in that paper, around the case. And that makes it even worse. I mean, obviously there are certain questions that need to be asked a potential jury to make sure that there is no problems with the people that are sitting on that jury. Maybe they know the people. Maybe they're prejudiced to some certain thing in that particular case. Maybe they know too much information about the case. I mean, things of that nature, of course. And, you know, there's probably a good, I'd say, small list of things that the juries should be asked, and to make sure that they're not a bias or a problem to the to being able to sit on that jury. But the question that these people asked and out there in Oregon is just unbelievable. And you know, and the things that they want to know. And I could tell you the ones I saw in New York here. And I haven't heard all of the questions out there in Oregon. I'm trying to get a copy of that paper. And I'm also trying to get, you know, the whatever I can on the transcripts of those hearings. I think it was 4 days of hearings, and they were quite long, you know, 5, 6, 7 hours long. But some of the questions on the New York papers that I had read, I mean, they literally asked them questions like, you know, what news program do you watch? And they'll give you choices, you know, Fox News, CNN, and so on. They ask you if you watch police programs. They ask you a lot of questions, which really is totally none of their business. Clearly, they're doing a psychological here and trying to pick out a particular jury that is minded in a certain way. And then they seem to, I know they chose, I think it was 1,500 people out there. Let me think about that was correct. Was it 1,500? It's quite a few. May have been more, but I think it was 1,500 people. And out of those 1,500 people, I don't know whether I want to say 15,000. It was a lot of people that they had chosen, but they're trying to break it down to 150 people. I think it was 1,500. And they're breaking it down to 150 people, which then those 150, once they chisel them out of the 1,500, if they want to be biased and they want to get the right people, and clearly this judge is doing that, you know, anybody who listens to this case can see that this judge is definitely doing that. They're getting 150 juries that they know. They don't care which ones come out of the wheel at that point. They put them in a wheel and they pull them out, you know. They really don't care which ones of the 150 come out, because they're going to get the ones that they want, the ones that's going to obey. You know, they actually took in people who second-guessed and was not happy with the Second Amendment. I mean, my goodness, why would you want someone who would not be happy with any of our amendments out of the Bill of Rights on any jury? That's a major problem, from my opinion. But anyway, those people were permitted into the wheel, into the final jury selection. So this is a major problem. This is a trial by government, period, with no possibility of anything outside of government. You have a judge which works for the government. You got the government prosecuting the case. You've got the U.S. attorney prosecutors work for the government. Even the appointed judges, I mean the appointed lawyers for the defendants, and all of them have appointed lawyers, I believe. Maybe a few don't, but most of them have appointed lawyers. They, too, work for the government. You had a grand jury, which it's even questionable whether they really went to see a grand jury. It's very possible, it appears most likely, that they just had this, robo-signed, I'll call it. I don't know what else to call it. And they got their indictment, and now they're going to have a government-controlled jury. These people don't have a chance. They can't possibly win. It's an impossibility for these people to win in this court. It's completely set up. And we need to make this point clear in that court and any other court we have to go to get this point across. So anyway.
Hey, John?
Yeah.
I'd like to make a couple comments on your memorandum jurisdiction before we get going too far and I forget. Well, I'll work my way backwards because you got into juries after that. You know, the fact that you know somebody should not be a fact that precludes you from a jury. When they say at a jury of your peers years ago, it was people in the community that knew you. Those are the ones who can best judge you. They got this thing now, oh, you're not supposed to know the person. That's a lie. You got a businessman or something, another businessman there. I mean, who better to judge that man than the people that know him? Now, that's not necessarily a conflict of interest. Now, maybe somebody who's getting their income from him or something like that would be a different story. But just because you know somebody, that was never.
Maybe if they got a very close friendship, or maybe they're an enemy or something.
But that doesn't mean just because you know somebody, you can't be a jurist in his case. As a matter of fact, you may be more qualified to be a jurist the fact that you know that person as an acquaintance or whatever than somebody who doesn't know him at all.
Well, you know, when Brent comes on, I maybe he'll address this issue, because I read in his book concerning this kind of an idea, and I think he even mentioned, and he'll correct me if I'm wrong here when he takes the mic, mentioned the fact that you just mentioned is they know them in the community. But go ahead.
Look, if you have a small community, the only way you're going to get somebody that doesn't know the man, you got to move the trial into a different community. And I mean, they do that stupid stuff, but it's really not necessary all the time just because somebody knows somebody. The only way that I think that they should do that is if the guy that's on trial says, I don't want any of those people in that town because they're all biased against me. Then in order to protect his rights, maybe you can move it to a different venue. But I don't think that the government should be able to make that decision as far as, you know the guy, so you can't rule on the guy, you know. But that's something we need to discuss. But what I want to say is every week, I'm going to switch gears now to your memorandum of jurisdiction and law. We get these questions about, is there any statutes other than like Cruden versus Neal that says that statutes and codes not applying to the common man? Well, everything you read in that memorandum answers that question. Look, those are Supreme Court rulings, but you don't need a statute to tell you what the right thing to do is. If it's repugnant to the Constitution, guess what? It's null and void. That's all you need to know. You don't have to hang your hat on a statute. What you need to do is you need to learn the Constitution, because anything that's repugnant, Marbury, Marshall, Madison, and all those other cases confirm that codes and statutes can't stand by themselves. And as far as, whether who they apply to, if they violate the unalienable rights of a person, they're null and void. That's it. There's nothing. You don't need to look for anything else. So I just want to get that through it. And most
well,
of all,
well, let me just add to that. You're absolutely right. The people have the power. Jefferson spoke about this. Nullification and is the proper course here when Jefferson was talking. I think it was the Kentucky Resolution. And, you know, nullification is the key here. We are the makers of the law. We are the final decision makers of the law. We can nullify anything at any given time in a courtroom. And that's a key point here. Without that power, without that authority, we then are ruled by legislators. And we cannot be ruled by legislators. They're our servants. We never gave legislators the power to write law. Let me repeat that. We never gave legislators the power to write law. We gave them the power to write legislation, which would be statutes, okay, but not law. We wrote the law. We lay out the law. Ultimately, the law is whatever we say it is, and ultimately the law ultimately is the law of God because we're under common law or natural law, whichever you may want to call it, but that's the law of God. The law is written in the hearts of men, and people have the unalienable right of judging other men. So we judge these other men. Not only do we use our minds, we use our hearts, and the law is written in the hearts of men. And thereby, by using those principles and using, you know, common sense, using the things that the law that God put into our hearts and making a ruling, now we're ruling on behalf of the king. And therefore, we do have a court of justice. And we can nullify any law. Sometimes the situation, even that obviously is wrong, may be considered okay in certain situations. And that's up to the jury to make a decision. They're the ones that's got to weigh things to discover whether really, a law has been broken or something, or somebody has to be punished or restitution needs to be paid or something. There was something recently, let me see if I can remember this. Juries are not there to uphold the law. Juries are there to uphold justice. Now, that's a powerful statement. As a matter of fact, that particular statement we have on our next paper, which we'll look at next week, I think it's shorter than this one, but that paper there is focused in on Article III courts, you know, and what kind of courts are lawful in America, and the difference between an administrative court and a court of justice, a difference between that which is statutory and that which is ultimately the law of the land. There's a big difference between all those things. And each of them have a place. But, of course, these people have brought them to places that are abusive and use them against the people. But anyway, go ahead, Gerard.
Well, they want to make you seem like you're crazy if you believe that you can judge the law, that you're crazy if you believe that we have the power to do these things as if somehow we don't have the intelligence to make these decisions. In other words, they want that IBM card. If the holes all line up and the pegs go in the hole, you don't need anything. That's it. You're done. You're guilty. The IBM card lined up. And that's actually what they're doing. You're making it a mechanical system. And you know, that whole Babylonian system, it's very easy because they pull the lever, and the crime comes out, and the penalty comes out, and you pay your money, and then it goes your way. That's what that's all about. So they designed this to make money easier for them. That's the whole bottom line right there. It's not about justice. It's about how much money can we rip off. And then when you come in and say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't apply to me, they look at you and say, oh, you need a mental evaluation. If you think that those laws don't apply to you, you must be crazy. So, you know, it's the old emperor has no clothes syndrome again. You know, they got us believing that this cloak that they have on, this big, beautiful cloak, is really some great gown, when in fact they're naked. They have no rights. They're null and void. And what they're doing is they're putting a fraud over on us. And that's why it's important for us when we go to these courts to proclaim the truth and reveal the fraud. And the more we do that, each little niche brings us closer to that freedom, that day when they finally understand that we the people are the sovereigns and that we have this ability that we've lost and they smoke and mirror and taken it away from us. Anyway, that's all.
Okay, thanks, John. All right, before we move over to Brent, do we have any questions out there, Jan? Did anything come in this week?
We have one question that came in. It says, By what authority does a judge have the right to put someone in jail for contempt of court?
Okay, you know what? I'm going to leave that ultimately to... Well, you know, first of all, if he's going to put someone in jail for contempt of court, I would imagine he'd have to give him due process before he can get him put him into jail. So they'd have to run some kind of a little trial there, I would imagine. But maybe Brent could answer that better than I could. Brent, are you there? Star 6 to unmute.
Now yeah, I'm here.
Okay, Brent is here. So we're going to move over. I'm going to let Brent answer that, but hang on one second, Brent. What were you going to say, Gerard?
I think Brent will answer. I was going to say there's two different types of being held in contempt. One is to elicit a certain response, and the other one is to punish. In other words, when they put that woman in jail that refused to hand out licenses for same sex, they would not let her out till she performed her duties. And there was no time limit on that other than what the judge said. But anyway, you go ahead, Brent.
Well, yeah, I want to make just one little thing because this kind of sprung something in my brain before I pass it over to Brent. Then we'll get his position on this because I think he's much more learned than we are in these areas. But here's something I realized, you know, from studying what we've been studying, particularly in jurisdiction, looking at the different court systems and what's available out there, what is in the Constitution available to the federal government is different than that to the states to begin with. And we'll talk about that next week. But one of the things I came to realize is that these statutory courts, any courts not of record, let me repeat that, any courts not of record, do not have the power to fine or incarcerate. So if they were to find someone in contempt, I'm not sure how far they can go with that. If it is a court of record, then the power of fining and incarcerating is there. So anyway, let's see what Brent has to say on this. Brent, maybe you could lead off with this before you go into anything you want to teach. And actually, I want to push two or three things on you. This question here that we're looking at, a second question is maybe you can respond to what Gerard was talking about as far as a jury of their peers, people known in the community. What's your thoughts on that? And then there is something else I want to bring up before you go into your thing. But anyway, Brent Winters, author of The Excellence in Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Go ahead, Brent.
Again, thank you, John and Gerard, for allowing me an opportunity to say a few words and prevent myself from bursting. Otherwise, I think I would. But you did a good job of leading off, too, and I don't have to – you get me pumped up before I get on to listening. And you had mentioned somebody had asked the question about contempt. And the question, I think, was by what authority does a court – can it hold a person in contempt? And first, maybe I ought to just say that to tune in to what John said while ago about courts of record, at common law, and this is still true in the United States, only courts of record have the true authority to hold a person in contempt. If a court does not have authority to hold a person in contempt, that's a badge that it's not a court of record. Now, some courts, of course, are not really courts. They're just administrative tribunals under the authority of the governor of your state or under the authority of the president of the United States, such as the United States Tax Court. They want you to think that that's a real judicial branch court. And the question has even gone before the Supreme Court, and they haven't given a clear answer, but I know clearly it is not a judicial branch court. But still, they want to retain the power to hold you in contempt. But the authority to hold a fellow in contempt is for a court of record, and it is inherent. The authority to hold a person in contempt is inherent in the judicial power, because the judge, the person sitting in that position, has the responsibility to determine what is his right jurisdiction. He has the responsibility to determine what is his right jurisdiction. And if there's anything in our common law tradition that stands out, it is that we in our common law tradition respect our courts. And We respect our courts not because we like the judge, not because the judges are doing what's lawful. We respect our courts because God said to. And that really ends the matter. And, of course, we discover by trial and error that it is a smart thing to do. I mean, even if you have to disagree with the court, you do it respectfully. That's part of our common law tradition. And that tradition arises from the idea that courts don't really have any force to apply. They do have some, but they don't have any compared to the president of the United States and the federal jurisdiction or the governors of the states. But judges in their own courtrooms, their power is plenary. It is often said of common law judges in their courts, the only thing that approaches the power of a judge in a common law court within the walls of his courtroom, within the reach of his voice, wherever that court may be being held, the only power that comes close is the captain, the skipper, the old man of a ship at sea under admiralty law. And the skipper of a ship at sea under the law of the sea has absolute power. He can marry a man and a woman. He can put men on bread and water, and that's still part of our naval tradition. He can hold court without the jury. He does it often. It's called captain's mast. Well, a judge in a courtroom, in a federal or state court, a court of record, and again, a court of record is a court that has the power to hold a person in contempt. And contempt, Gerard made the correct point, there's two kinds of contempt. There is, he didn't use these words, but I'll use them to flesh it out even more. Civil contempt, which is the court's power, it's not criminal, just the power of the court to compel a fellow to do something that it wants, says that he must do. And then there is criminal contempt. And that is where you make a personal, a man makes a personal affront to the judge, to his face, in the presence of the judge. Tells him off. I know a man, met him, I don't know what happened to him, but he, after his sentencing in a criminal trial in federal court, he told the judge where he could pack it. And the judge gave him 5 more years on the spot. And then they told him something else, and he gave him 5 more, wound up being 10. That's criminal contempt, to tell the judge off to his face. Civil contempt where the judge tells you to do something. For example, well, the judge says you must produce these documents, and you say, well, no, the law says that I'm not a corporation. I don't have to produce those documents. And the judge says, yes, but you are the beneficiary or the trustee of a trust. I'm speaking of a case I was really involved in, and the judge says you have to produce them because a trust is a corporation. And the defendant says, no, a trust is not a corporation. There is no corporate body here, no creature of the state. And I'm the trustee or I'm the beneficiary, and I own the property outright, personally, as trustee. And the judge says, well, I disagree with you. And briefs are filed, and this is what really happened. And the judge said, well, I'm not persuaded. I think that you do not have a Fifth Amendment right to not produce, so you must produce. And if you don't produce, and this is what the judge said in this case, I'm going to put you in jail. Now, that's not criminal contempt, because it came when the lawyers argued back and forth and filed briefs and were all very respectful. The client was respectful, didn't tell the judge off, and the judge said, well, here's what I'm going to do, Mr. Defendant. I'm going to put you in jail. But because this isn't criminal contempt, this is just civil contempt. I'm trying to compel you to what I believe the law is. I'm going to test your mettle. I'm going to test your conviction. So I'll put you in jail, but I'm going to put the jailhouse key in your pocket. And anytime you want out, all you have to do is pull that key out and use it. Well, the key is agreeing to do what the judge says. Now, by tradition, and this is not a matter of statute law, it wasn't what happened in my case anyway, unless a statute's been passed. By tradition, a judge cannot jail a person for non-criminal contempt, or usually doesn't, I should say, over 6 months. And at the outside, never more than 18 months. But friends, neighbors, and relatives, that's a long time. If you've ever been in jail that long, you know what I mean. That's a very long time. Now, if you'll recall, Susan McDougal from down in Arkansas during the Whitewater scandal, she was told to testify. And she said, I have a Fifth Amendment right. And the judge said, well, no, I don't believe you do. It's my judgment of the law, you don't. She said, well, I believe I do. And it went back and forth, and they argued back and forth and filed their briefs. And finally he said, I'm not persuaded. You got to talk. Because the information that you have here is, I don't remember whether it was under immunity or what it was. She said, well, I'm not saying a word. And the reason she said she's not going to get on the stand and talk is because she said it might end her life. Someone would kill her if she talked. At any rate, she went to jail. I think it was for 18 months. She stayed for 18 months, and she won. Then, of course, that doesn't give you a criminal record, but it's a hard case. It's a rather curious and strange doctrine, this whole idea of contempt and jailing people, but at common law, that's what we do, and that's what we've been doing for centuries. But I would advise people, whatever you do, and of course, this is just good common sense. It never pays to tell anybody off unless, I don't know, there has to be an exception, but it never really pays, but especially in our common law courts, and to do so is to be lawless. God says don't do it. Our common law says don't do it. So just don't do it. Find some other way to get your way. The only remedy to lawlessness, if you think a judge is lawless, the only remedy is law. And it would be wrong for anyone to violate the law to get at the judge. I had a fellow tell me the other day, if I've repeated this before, bear with me, those that remember. He was doing a lot of arresting of people, citizens' arrests at county board meetings and things because they weren't following the law. They were shutting people out, and the Sunshine Law said people had a right to be in the meetings. So he'd hold them under arrest. He'd gotten away with it, and he said, if I go to court and the judge rules against me, I'm going to arrest him. I said, you're sure you want to do that? He said, yes, because I'm committed to the law. And he was ignorant of the standard there. He wasn't a lawless guy. So I told him what I knew about it, and he said, well, I didn't know that. He said, I'm not going to try to arrest the judge. But he said, and we'd talked about this, I said, it's against the law, common law, to arrest a judge during court. You can't do that. He shouldn't let you. He should fight you physically if he has to. And there have been plenty of cases where that's happened. That's sacrosanct. You don't do that. Now, after court might be another matter. But, of course, the catch-22 there is that a citizen's arrest can only be for a felony, not a misdemeanor. And it has to be, if you catch the fella, the guilty party, in the very act of the felony. That's kind of the standard. There are some variations, but that's pretty much it. Well, by the time court's out, it'd be hard to arrest the judge because you're not catching him in the act. But maybe you could. Maybe there's an exception there somehow, a fact pattern of which I'm unaware. But that's the law of contempt. And by the way, just to get it straight, it pays to operate always by first principles. The question being, where does authority come from for contempt? Well, I'll tell you, the answer is always the same. Whenever anybody ever says, where does the authority come from? If it's true authority, if it's true right, well, the answer is it comes from God, the creator of all things. Romans chapter 13, verses 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Go back and read them. And I suggest, however, you read those verses in the Geneva Bible. Don't read them in the King James. The King James was tilted there by the translators to give King James power through his prelates and others. And there are a couple of words that are added, and it's translated power instead of authority, like it ought to be translated. Geneva makes some of the same mistakes, but if you know that one thing that it's talking about authority there, not power, there's a difference. You know, people have the power to do wrong, but nobody has the right or the authority to do wrong, and therein lies the difference. Well, you can purge yourself of civil contempt, as Gerard said, non-criminal contempt, but criminal contempt, you can't purge yourself of that. You may get a jail sentence out of that one. I had a friend once that was in federal court. He'd tried about 50 full-blown jury trials in federal court in criminal tax cases, and the U.S. prosecutor said, I want to put him on the stand because I know that his client told him some things that the court would be interested to know to make the right decision here. And so the judge said, well, Mr. So-and-so, I won't repeat his name here, he said, you're going to have to get on the stand. And he shot back in the heartbeat. He said, what's said between me and my client is between me and my client. And the judge said, well, he said, you're an old military man. He said, do an about-face for me. And he did. And he did an about-face, and he was standing face-to-face with the United States Marshal standing there. And he said, I want to introduce you to this U.S. Marshal here. And just by the way, I want you to know also, he does what I say. He won't do what you say. I know I've had this experience before. So he said, are you sure you don't want to get on the witness stand? Well, the end of the story came out good, and they finally settled the matter. But again, the judge has to make a decision. If he decides wrong, then you got to, if you really think you're right, you got to go head-to-head with him. It's part of the duty of a citizen, an unfortunate part of the duty of a citizen of these states, that sometimes you get thrown in jail, and it's your duty to submit in such a case. It's your duty to do the right thing in such a case. In such a case of non-criminal contempt, that's sometimes what happens. And if you've got the guts and you think you're right, it's your duty to stick it out. 6 months usually is what it takes. Well, that's just the practicalities of the rule of contempt. It's not something that's taught in law school at all, unless things have changed since I was there. But it is something you can read up on if you find the right information. Now, the other thing that was brought up here was about juries and peers. Peer, Magna Carta, written in Latin, not English, written in Latin by a fellow by the name of Stephen Langton. Stephen Langton. And to help you remember who this man is, Stephen Langton, I like to add, and it's a curious fact, Stephen Langton is the man that gave us the chapter divisions of our Bibles that we still use today. He was the preeminent Old Testament commentator of his day. He was Archbishop, later appointed, he was appointed Archbishop of Canterbury, which is the chief position in the Christian, in Christendom, in England, still is, I suppose. But he's the one that drafted it. He drafted it in Latin so that the whole world would read it, because at that time the international language was Latin. And so when he speaks there, he's not inventing anything. Magna Carta, as our Constitution, is a restatement of common law first principles of government. Now, Magna Carta is more haphazardly put together, and a lot of the things in it have to do with facts. For example, fish weirs are a big subject in Magna Carta. Fish weirs. Well, what's a fish weir? That's a thing that people use to catch, and engines for catching fish. Very important problem, and it had to do with the jurisdiction between admiralty law and common law. And the things like that are in Magna Carta. But trial by jury is part of the observations of Magna Carta. It's not making up anything new. It's something that had been in existence among the Anglos, the Saxons, and the Danes for centuries, even on the continent of Europe, around that peninsula called Jutland, today known as Denmark. The Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes, the Danes, the Vikings, they were sometimes called, all lived there, and they all migrated to England at different times and populated the island and pushed the other inhabitants back a little, the Celts, the Celtic peoples. But all of those people, the Celts and the Danes and the Angles, or the Anglos, as we say today, and the Saxons, all of them had a like law. The tribe, the Welsh, the Picts, the Scots, the Cornishmen, they all had a like law with the Angles and the Saxons. And you can go back, by the way, I'll just mention this in passing, it's a fascinating subject, cited by Sir Flinders Petrie, and back about 1920, it was 1917, I believe. Yeah, it was 1917. And he cited the kings of these groups I just mentioned and the records of them, and they're substantiated records. And they're all interrelated for some reason. But speaking of the jury, that's the subject I was getting to. That's the institution of our common law. I've read books on the history of the jury, more than one, of some of the greatest men to ever study. I say greatest, I mean the men that had spent their lives trying to learn about it. And the reason for the 12-man petit jury, or petite, as the Norman French used to say, the reason for it is lost to many in the fog of antiquity. We can trace it back a long, long ways, back to the Teutonic tribes of, again, Northern Europe, and what the Romans had to say about it when they came up against them. But then the trace is lost, reaching back to the ancient times. But it is my own conclusion, and it's substantiated. Even though the trace is lost, it arises again. And it comes from the law of God as the Bible has revealed it. It is no accident that Jesus Christ chose 12 men off the street. Just off the street, some would say today. Of course, there weren't any streets, but 12 men just standing around to be witnesses of his messiahship and to testify to it later. And they all did, by the way. And all 11 of them were killed for their testimony. They died for what they said, and they knew they'd die. And the other one died in chains in a salt mine on the Isle of Patmos. That was John. But Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton, an essayist from Australia back in the 30s, the 20s and 30s, wrote an essay after he'd gone to jury duty. Of course, Australia, like America, is a common law country fundamentally, same roots. He went to jury duty, and he said, why do we have juries? He wrote an essay on the subject, and he said, I finally concluded the reason we have juries, it isn't that all police officers are bad men. It isn't that all judges are bad men. It isn't that all bailiffs and lawyers are bad men. But it is true, he said, that these policemen, bailiffs, and judges, and lawyers, he said, they just get too used to it. They get too used to the whole process. And they, these lawyers and judges and policemen, there is no way, said Chesterton, that any of those men could have felt what I felt sitting in the jury box and listening to all this, because they're hard to it. They live with it every day. He's absolutely correct. That's what happens. And lawyers weren't on juries in America until very recently. Now it seems to be something that's accepted, but they weren't even allowed. Everybody just knew for decades that since our country began, lawyers shouldn't be on juries. Well, and for the reason Chesterton cited. But then Chesterton said this. He said, if we want to catalog a massive library, or we want to find another galaxy, or name a new planet or a star, he said, we consult the experts. But if we want to decide who lives or dies in a criminal case of rape or murder, we just grab 12 guys standing around in the street and ask them what to do with it. And that's fact. And therein lies the great genius of our common law, because the jury doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. Now, I have heard cases where there is a jury, for example, in Austria, and they've got one in Sweden, somebody told me. But don't be fooled, friends. These aren't juries. These are just window dressing to pacify people, to make them think that they're like us. They aren't. And then the jury's decision is unlike our jury decisions, as was mentioned a while ago. The jury decision of the facts in America is not to be questioned in any other place, except by the rules of the common law, and that's pretty narrow. In other words, that the jury cheats or something, or there's something that subverts justice. And that does happen sometimes. But only in the English-speaking world, the common law world, are juries even used. And we trace them back to the mind of God himself, who appointed 12 witnesses to the facts of the case, the facts of the matter, to testify and give their testimony to the world of the evidence they saw of the messiahship and the utter deity of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Now, the jury in our common law courts is the same. The job is the same today. The jury sits in the trial, and they witness the evidence. They are 12 witnesses sworn. That's what juror means. It means sworn one, sworn to do certain things, to testify, to witness, to see with their own eyes and ears and hear the testimony with their own ears and see with their eyes the tangible evidence, and then come to a conclusion on the facts. And by the way, whoever controls the facts controls everything. And it is true that common law juries have the power to judge the law, and the government hates that, and they'll do anything to get around it, and they do. But there's no question that the jury foremost is a decider of the facts. That's number one. And the reason that has to be number one is because once they decide the facts, everything else takes care of itself if the law, the true law is followed. In murder cases, for example, it's no small thing that the jury is asked to give us the facts, who done it, where, why, and how, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the facts. But then the judge will say to the jury, I want you to tell me, should this man live or die? That decision is also given to the jury. Never forget that in most cases. And I say this, if we're going to give that decision to the jury, which is not a question of fact, that's a question of law, and that's traditionally what we do, then we ought to give that question to the jury in all matters, because in a murder case, that's the greatest of crimes against God and man. And if we're going to give them the power to decide the law there, and we do, then we need to give them the power to decide the law everywhere else and tell them so. It is true. But still, come back to this. The facts are where the real power is, ultimately. And the facts belong to the truth and the person who's telling the truth. And I tell my clients, I like clients that are innocent for whatever reason, and I like to tell them, the facts belong to us. They do not belong to them. And I, when I'm in that position, I feel fully confident. And I give them an opportunity to do right. And if they don't, then they pile up wrath against the day of wrath. Every time you go into court and do what's right and tell the truth, even if the judge says you lose, all he's doing is piling up trouble for himself, unless he, of course, fully persuaded in his heart of hearts. Sometimes, I suppose, like all men, they are, and sometimes they aren't. But what is a peer? I got off. A peer is in Latin. Boy, I left that a long time ago, that Latin subject. That's where I was going. It's written in Latin, and Stephen Langton, that fellow that gave us the chapter divisions of our Bibles, uses the Latin word pares, P-A-R-E-S, pares, and translated peers. It's related to our word pair, P-A-I-R, as a pair of shoes. You know, a pair of shoes are peers one to another. They aren't the same thing. As a matter of fact, they're kind of mirror images of one another, the way shoes are made today. But back then, in those old days, they were, of course. You couldn't tell a shoe whether it went on the right foot or the left until this last century, they tell me. I wasn't around back then, but that's what the old timers tell me. But a pair is something that corresponds to. Something that corresponds to. The Old Testament uses a word like that, and it's something that corresponds to. And you can, for example, see it in Genesis chapter 15, where God makes his promise to Abraham. It's a unilateral promise. Abraham promised nothing. He wasn't conditioned on anything. He knocked Abraham out. And then he had Abraham, before that, though, cut animals in two from the tip of their nose to their tail, from anterior to posterior, and to place the two identical pieces, mirror images of one another, the old King James says, over against one another. That means across from one another. And then he walked, or God, in a form of a burning lamp, went between the pieces to substantiate his promise. But that was an ancient custom that God used to communicate what he had done. But those pieces of those animals were cut from nose to tail, split in two, like fish to be broiled, and then laid aside. The Bible uses the Hebrew word ra, which means corresponding to, same as. And a peer is one who corresponds to you. How? Well, he's at your station in life. He is probably in your economic condition. Maybe even the same color as you. We've gone far afield from what a peer is. We've gone far afield. Now, when the idea of peer arose, peer as a jury, in the common law, there were no classes of people like there are were later in England after the year 1066. And by the year 1215, the old Anglo-Saxon ideal, people wanted to revive it. You know, when the Normans got there, they had come from the continent. They were pretty feudal, and the imprint of Rome was on them. And they divided people into classes, and England still has that, by the way. They have the peerage. The peerage, there's that word again, peer. Well, the peerage are those high-class people that they say have noble blood. They can pass their blood on, and all those people get to belong to the upper house of the parliament called the House of Lords, L-O-R-D-S, and everybody there except the clergymen. There's clergymen in the House of Lords also. They're called Lord, but these fellows have a title in front of their name called Sir, titles of nobility, which our Constitution forbids, of course. We wanted to get away from that. But Magna Carta was an attempt to get away from all that idea of peerage as being something that places people above other people. But it is true that in old England, there were people of different economic classes, and for example, the lord of the manor, the old thane, the old Anglo-Saxon thane that ran the farm, he wasn't a peer to the guy that ran the plow, that handled one of the gangs on the plow. And so the peers were the fellows that were the same status as you. Yeah, we've got far afield from that, very far. And the government now, the prosecutors, have gone so far even as to say in cases that you have to swear an oath to obey the instructions of the judge. You have to swear an oath, and they ask, will you swear this oath and do it? And if you say no, well, they'll throw you off right now, and the judge will back them up. Well, that's skewing the law quite a bit. That's pretty devious. What if you take an oath to obey the instructions of the judge as to the law, or as to anything, the facts, and then you discover that the judge, in your heart of hearts, you believe he was wrong? What should you do? Do you still have to obey what you believe to be wrong? Now, this, what comes in here is a forgotten principle, and it used to be fundamental. It's another document that was written to Parliament by the clerics, by the clergy of England. And Parliament had requested during the English Civil War that the clergymen of Scotland and England would come together at Westminster, down there across the river from London, and that they would answer the questions that Parliament put to them on certain subjects, because Parliament at that time didn't want to pass any laws, any legislation, I should say, to be accurate, that were contrary to the Bible. And so they called them together and they submitted the questions. And one of the questions they submitted was this: what if a person takes an oath that he later discovers is an unlawful oath? Unlawful. In other words, he's taken an oath to do something that he thought was lawful, then he found out later it was unlawful, or he took an oath that was unlawful, knowing it was unlawful, and then decided he wanted to reform himself, and later said, I don't want to follow this law, this oath I took, what do I do? You know, some oaths you take, you can take an oath to do an unlawful thing. For example, the book of Acts, a bunch of Jews got together, and they said, they swore an oath, and they did it in blood, it says, a blood oath. They cut themselves, signed their names in blood or something. But they swore that they would not eat or drink until they had murdered Paul the Apostle. They would not eat or drink, they said. Well, that's an unlawful oath. Do you have to follow an unlawful oath? They maybe thought that what they were doing was the right thing. But Paul, he used to do those kind of things too. He used to kill Christians. And as a Jew, he thought that was the right thing to do. And he discovered later, he said, the light came on. And he said, I didn't understand. Now I know, and I'm not going to follow. He took all those kind of blood oaths as a Pharisee. It was a Babylonian religion. He took them all to kill, to steal, to deceive. And he said, I did it all. That's part of the Talmudic system. And he said, I deny all those oaths. Let's bring it back home. Now, that was the right thing to do. Well, the men of Westminster said, if you've taken an unlawful oath, you have a duty that is immediate to disregard it. Because you're taking an oath to do something unlawful, you have a duty, not an option, a duty to disregard it. So if you take an oath to obey the instructions of a judge, the juror, and you believe once you try to apply those instructions that the law is wrong or something's wrong, and you believe in your heart of heart, that's your job as a juror, to disregard an unlawful oath. And that advice that Parliament gave, by the way, that the clergymen, Reformed Protestant clergymen of Scotland, the Presbyterians, and of England, the Puritans, that advice was given blow by blow and formed later into a document called the Westminster Confession. It's now the fundamental expression of how to handle the law of God for some major, or well-known, I should say, Presbyterians being one of them, Protestant denominations, Bible-believing if they are, the Westminster Confession. It's not the Bible, but it is an expression of the laws of nature, and the laws of nature is God, that, and beyond its accuracy, I've never found one any better. It's very good. I suppose I could say a few things differently to make them clearer. And there are some places that I know for a fact, having read the procedure and what they did, that they were purposely ambiguous because they didn't want to take a position because they were afraid it would cause too much rancor. Having to do with equity, by the way. But it does communicate the laws of nature and the laws of nature of God and how they dovetail together. But again, to repeat, if you go in for jury duty and they tell you to take an oath to obey the instructions of the judge, there's nothing wrong with taking that oath. Nothing wrong at all. And there's nothing wrong with saying, I'll follow it. But if you discover that what the judge has instructed you to do, he's wrong, it's your duty, not your option, your duty as a juror, to disregard the oath and do what's right. It's always every man and every woman's duty to disregard everything and everybody that he believes is wrong and make his own decisions. And if there is any place in our country that a person must be of independent mind to do his duty and not depend on anybody else in the jury, whether in the jury room or out, it's as a juryman. And the genius of our jury tradition and common law depends upon the independent mind of every person on the jury. Well, that's a lot of talk. I hope I hit the nail on the head. I hope to, and I want to do this, John, if it's all right. I won't talk very long, but just to keep the ball rolling, say a few things about the militia. The militia.
Yeah, go right. Well, but before you do, let me just get this one quick thing in here to get the nail on the head a little better.
Okay.
Gerard had mentioned the idea of a person sitting on the jury actually knowing the person. Yeah, I have kind of a conflict with that idea in the sense that if he understands and knows the person's character, he's already acting in bias right off from the gate. So I think that's a problem. But maybe if knowing the person from the standpoint of, well, I'm familiar that this person is in the community, maybe he's the son or the nephew of Mary and Joe or whatever, but not knowing the character or anything that could make him biased for or against. Uh-huh. Well, what's your thoughts from what you've learned as far as actually knowing the individual, and particularly the character is a problem, I think, but what
yes.
do you think?
Well, I think your objections are well thought out. I know they are, John, just knowing you a little bit. And so I don't disregard them. But at common law, anciently, a peer was somebody that knew you. He lived right beside you. He was in your neighborhood. He was your neighbor out on the rural road out there on the village farm. And you were entitled to be judged by people that knew you. Now, we've gone afield from that, and here's another funny thing. You talk about bias, and that's an important matter of fact, bias is always relevant. There's never a time at common law bias is not relevant if it's there. But when it comes to the jury, they'll ask, usually in the jury pool, in the cases, they'll ask, are you biased one way or another in this case or against this person or that, et cetera? And, of course, people will always say, oh, no, I'm not biased. Well, if we did the right thing, we'd excuse them right on the spot from being a juror for being a liar. There's no such thing as a man or a woman that's not biased. What is bias? Well, bias, again, is an old French-Norman law word, came from the Normans, and it's used in our courts. And bias, in the old French tongue, referred to a billiard ball that its weight was off-center. And so when you punched it with the cue, it would always slice to one direction or the other. No matter what you did, it would always roll that way because that's the way it was made on the inside. And all of us are made on the inside a little bit off, one direction or another on any given subject. Because of our unique experiences, we're all different. And so we've thrown aside what bias really is. Bias is not always a bad thing. Now, when it comes to a judge, yeah, you don't want any bias, and he doesn't need to really, he doesn't have to be a peer, but it's inevitable. I'm from a rural community. The judge knows everybody, and everybody knows the judge and the family, by the way, for two or three generations back. That's more true back in the eastern part of the country, the generational thing, than it is when you get back on the left coast, way out west, in a transient world in some places out there, especially California. But to really know a person is to be able to have mercy on them. You understand his mom, his dad, his grandma and grandpa, or the fact that maybe he didn't have parents, or You know, it's not always such a bad thing. Peers are those who live in your community. And we like to have, that's why, of course, our Constitution says that jurors must be drawn from the district where the crime occurred. Well, I one time was involved in a case in California, in a federal court, and every defendant, there were five of them in that case, were from different states, most of them back east. And there's no way that they were going to get a jury of peers. They were just traveling when it happened. They were family. And there was no way they were going to get a jury of peers. Now, so we're up against a problem that we haven't solved. And the things that you've said, John, are concerns. How do we weigh that out? And what Gerard has said about peers. And, of course, we're still arguing about it. And I figure probably, John, you and Gerard have read Spooner's exposition of Magna Carta's jury of peers. I would recommend it to everybody there. You can download it from the Internet for nothing. It's free. Lysander Spooner's exposition. And he expounds in great detail the few words there in Magna Carta that talk about the jury. It doesn't use the word jury, but being tried by one's peers. I just comments to make. I'm not coming to any conclusions about it, just throwing out ideas. John?
Okay, all right. I appreciate your comments. And for those who would like to get an audio copy and a written copy of Lysander Spooner, on our website under Education, I believe it's under Essays and Lectures, you'll find Lysander Spooner and you'll in audio and Lysander Spooner in written word in a book. It's a PDF book. So, okay, appreciate that. We'll let you go on. We're going to cut you a little short tonight because you spent a lot of time. And when you get to the end of things, I do have one question for you. It's
all
kind
right.
of on another subject, but someone else wanted to say something?
Yeah, this is Jan. I'm sitting here and looking at the state of Oregon and all of the counties there and the number of jurists left in the pool for each county. Now, where Portland is, that's Multnomah County. There's 62 jurists there. Clackamas has 31. Washington, 45. Marion has 25. Lynn, 10. All the rest have less than that. Now, if you go to Harney County, where the crime took place, there are zero jurists. You go to Grant County, right next door, there are zero jurists. You go west one county from Harney, there are no jurists drawn. If you go north from Grant, there's four more counties that have no jurists drawn from them. What do you think about that non-restitution of jurists?
Okay, yeah. Brent, are you familiar with what he's talking about with the case out in Oregon?
Well, a little bit. Not as much as you and he are, but I think I see what he's saying. It's inequitable the places from where they're drawing the jurors. Is that what you're driving at?
Right.
Yeah, and that's common in federal courts. Federal courts, boy, they got this down to science. They know how to get what they want, and the juries are stacked often in federal court. I've seen it with my own eyes to the point where I wouldn't even object because so many things were done that were lawless and unlawful. You can't object to all of them. You have to pick which ones to object to, or you'd have to shut down the whole caboodle at every point. But herein lies the genius of the jury. It only takes one. It is not a majority institution. It's not a democracy because it's not a majority, and neither is it a Republican institution. Republican government refers to a legislature. That's really all it amounts to. And in old England, when they fought the Civil War there, they were fighting for what they called Republican principles. By the time we got to America, we said, yeah, that's important, but that's not the bottom line. The English Civil War made it the bottom line so much that Parliament became and remains in England utterly sovereign. The legislature is sovereign. Well, that's not true in America. We backed up and said, now, wait a minute. This Republican government business is okay, but any single will being sovereign is tyranny. And some of the states, Pennsylvania notably, after the Revolution, our separation from Britain, discovered that a legislature can be just as much, if not more so, tyrannical than a governor or any other kind of a king. And so it had to come back to the co-equal powers of government. The Republican part of our government is the representative legislature. That's a majority institution. That is not a common law institution as such. But it's part of what we do because it's helpful. But to talk about it like it's the all that ends all is false. That's not who we are. It's never been who we are. We've gone from the word democracy, and most people that are paying attention know that we're not a democracy. But now the evil empire, by a twisting of circumstances and emphasis, have instituted the word Republican. No, that's not it either. And notwithstanding all of the things that the founders are said to have said, Republicanism is important, and our Constitution says, now let me get to that quick, because I wanted to mention, I think that's what I was going to, yeah, let me read this. This is all, this one clause, and then I'll get off, John. I wanted to talk about the militia being mentioned in other parts of the Constitution of the United States besides the four militia clause. This is Article 4, Section 4, Clause 1. The United States shall guarantee to every state in this Union a republican form of government, and shall protect each one of them against invasion, and on application of the legislature or of the executive, when the legislature cannot be convened, against domestic violence. And I think it's important, do not wrench more from this republican form clause than it holds. It requires, it says the United States shall, it requires that the general government sitting in Washington, D.C. ensure each state has a republican form of government. I'm quoting. But know well, it is the form that the general government is to ensure, and no more. The form, and no more. And federal meddling with the inner workings of state government is off limits entirely. This clause gives no jurisdiction for the feds to intermeddle with state government. In a republican form of government, the people elect representatives to a legislature for purposes of fair taxation and to declare, if necessary, war. Two things. To ensure fair taxation, this is the legislature, the reason for it, this is the reason for the United States Congress, most fundamentally, to ensure fair taxation and to declare, if necessary, war. And by the way, that's a power of state legislature also. In addition, the following four observations I want to talk about here. First, the Supreme Court says Congress, not our courts, must decide whether state's government is republican in form. Accordingly, Congress holds that by its seating a state's senators and representatives, it recognizes that the people of that state have duly elected their senators and congressmen, and thus the state's government has republican form, and that ends the inquiry. There's nothing else to ask, no meddling to occur. They're not even to ask, how did your elections go? Were they fair? That's not Congress's business, necessarily. They start by saying, if you send somebody to Washington to represent you in the House of Representatives and the Senate, that ends the matter, unless something else is raised, there's some other evidence that they don't know about. The second, this clause requires the general government to protect each state against invasion, and this power runs concurrent with each state's power to protect itself by calling out to muster its own militia to protect itself against invasion. And third, a state's legislature can request help from the general government in Washington, D.C. to put down riots or other internal violence if it wants to. But the president has no jurisdiction to do so, according to this, unless the legislature makes such a request. A state's governor may also make such a request if the violence is keeping the legislature from meeting. You see, if the violence is so bad in the state capitol, the legislature can't even find its way into a burning city to sit down because the building's been burned down, then the governor has the power to request help from the president. But the president doesn't have jurisdiction to do that unless the request is duly sent to him according to law. And then this clause, by requiring the president to get a state's legislative consent before using national force against domestic violence within that state, all this limits his power. But using this constitutional principle, even county sheriffs have required notice before allowing federal action in their own counties. And I'll cite one example and then I'll quit, John. During the Pullman strike, the Pullman Company was in Chicago. They made Pullman passenger cars, very popular at one time for railroads. The year was 1894. The president of the United States was a fellow named Cleveland, and he sent national troops into Illinois to put down the strike. The governor of Illinois was a fellow by the name of Altgeld. He objected. He said, it's unconstitutional for you to do this. I did not request it. But Cleveland, the president, used the excuse saying that the strike at the Pullman plant in Chicago threatened future movement of the U.S. mail. Now notice, he didn't say it threatened movement of the U.S. mail. He didn't say it is impeding movement of the U.S. mail. He said that really it could in the future threaten movement of the U.S. mail. And the U.S. troops called out to put down the Pullman strike killed 13 people. Now we ought to rightly say they murdered 13 people because they were not there according to due process, according to the way the Constitution said it's supposed to happen. That's murder. In 1957, President Eisenhower put the Arkansas National Guard under national control to remove it from the command of Governor Favis. Now, that doesn't have to do with the militia, but the principle still applies. If the president calls the militia of the state out first, he gets jurisdiction. If the governor beats him to the punch and calls the militia of his state or any part of it out first, he gets jurisdiction and the president can't get it back. That's the law of our land. That's the due process of our Constitution. We call that concurrent jurisdiction of the president and the governor of a state. They run concurrently. It depends on who calls it out first. That's all I had, John. Just wanted to mention those things about Republican form of government, the militia, and how those kind of go together and what Republican form is. Thanks again, John. Appreciate it.
Okay, I appreciate that. All right, I got another question, and maybe we'll give time for one or two questions after this from people out that are listening in. But we're looking into, I've been studying particularly the federal district courts and, of course, looking at what we call the Article III courts. But in the process of looking into these courts, we see that we have 94 federal district courts that cover, all 50 states. And we also have what appears to be the Court of Appeals, which is broken up into 12 sections geographically. It appears from the entire United States. So each one of these 94 districts fall within the Courts of Appeals of a particular geographical area, which is the first level of appeal. And you'll correct me if I'm wrong on this. Then, of course, above that, you have the Supreme Court, which is the one court with a national jurisdiction. The one Supreme Court that the Constitution calls for. Now, that's how I see and that's how I understand. Now, operating properly, that's another question, and I don't want to necessarily get into that at the moment. But someone had brought up, and this has been brought up maybe at least three times in my looking into these things and trying to figure these things out, that there is a court because all these courts are in disobedience to the Constitution, including the United States Supreme Court. And the way they're operating and what they're doing, again, is a lot of questionable things. But I had heard this on a couple occasions, and recently someone brought this to our attention. Hopefully Gerard's here because I think he knows a little more about what this individual was speaking and took better notes than I did. But he mentioned that there seems to be a court in Washington, D.C., I'm pretty sure he referred to, Gerard, if you're there, pipe in a minute or two. I think he referred to him as a court of appeals in Washington, D.C., that says this court was the original where John Jay sat. Okay, this is the original court and not the United States Supreme Court where we have those nine up there now. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about? Is this bizarre or is there some truth to it or do you know something about these things?
I know I'm not practicing the court, but when I read about it, I catch a little here and a little there. The D.C. Circuit is what you're talking about, I'm guessing, and that was the circuit upon which, it's the circuit, it's the court that handles all the challenges to the constitutionality of what goes on in Washington, D.C., because it's right there. So in that jurisdiction, a senator wants to sue the president, that or some congressman wants to sue some agency, it goes to that particular court in D.C., federal court of appeals. Is that what you're talking about?
It may be. And again, you know, I'm trying to understand this. Here's the problem, as I'm sure you know how serious the problem is out there with these federal courts, that they are not really following the Constitution. They're following something else. And I don't want to get into that which they're following. That's something we could talk about another time. And that might even be debatable. I mean, you know, all I know is that they're in jurisdictions foreign to what we should be in. And we're trying, of course, to get through the courts, to get through someplace where these courts, where someone would really uphold the law of the land. And it was suggested to us that we go to this particular court out there in Washington. I don't know that that would make any more of a difference than going to any other court. If anything, I heard some responses of some courts outside in the District of Columbia, for instance, maybe I forget where they were coming from, maybe the Philippines or some other district outside Guam or something, where they actually responded properly to a case where the courts here inside the states are responding improperly. In other words, and also I heard also, again, this is hearsay, that there is a group of judges that actually have been studying the common law, very interested in the common law, and they're active somewhere. The question is where? Are you familiar with any of these kind of other courts that would be legal on American soil that is actually operating, that we actually could go in and get a common sense conversation with them, so to speak, through papers to get the work of the people done to deal with the subversion that's being taken place by enemies both foreign and domestic from inside our government at every level and with all three branches? You know, are you familiar with anything of what I'm trying to speak about? And again, I'm kind of just acting off of what things that I hear, but I haven't seen anything of validity. So,
no, I'm not aware of any group of judges that are really committed to the law of the land. And when we say the common law, we're talking about the law of the land. We're talking about the way things are done, the process, the course of the common law that's required. I was at a meeting in Texas here about a month ago, and a judge showed up, and he was from Louisiana. He'd been he wasn't a federal judge, he was a state judge, and he teamed up with a judge in this town, and they made a presentation at the meeting. I didn't expect it. I didn't know they were going to be there, and they were talking about their commitment to the Bible, and they wanted to make sure that each one of the justices committed themselves in all of their rulings to not Supreme Court justices, I forgot to say, that they wouldn't violate the first principles of our Bibles. And they had a copy of the Bible there, pictures of it, not a copy. They had a copy of a replica of it, and then they were passing that around. And they wanted to send that copy to each of the justices, but the justices, there's a Bible that sits in the Supreme Court building, and a tradition for each of the judges to sign it and sign there that they will indeed enforce or not violate the principles of the Bible. And I didn't know this. I went to the Internet, and I found copies of it, and amazingly, they had all signed it, including people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Now, this is mockery in the extreme, that this is going on. It's been going on for several decades. This Bible was presented, I believe, by first presented to the Supreme Court by Supreme Court Justice, I think it's Sutherland, but maybe somebody can look, but they've been signing it out of tradition. This is how screwy things get in places of high power. The organization of the judges is squarely against truth. And the forces that control judges serendipitously, in other words, they control them from behind the scenes. The judges don't really understand what's happening. And they're being taught things that are wrong. An example, what's happening is this. There's something called the Judicial Council that's out in Reno, Nevada, at the University of Reno, and funded privately by a bunch of left-wing people of a religious persuasion that is abhorrent to God. And they say to all the judges in America, state and federal, you're in a position now where you're going to have to deal with some problems, and we know that you don't know what you're doing. This is, and of course, no judge knows what he's doing when he gets into office. He just tries to start learning. And they say to them, and these same kind of people say the same thing to congressmen when they go to Congress. We've got all the resources you need. We've got all the information. We can teach you. We offer courses. We'll teach you how to handle every situation. We're here to help you. They come across with that attitude. Well, of course, with that comes their point of view. It's all free, and with that they control the Congress of the United States and a lot of the judges. Now, I'm not saying every judge falls into that hole, but certainly it has a grand impact upon our judicial system. And it is Babylon. The evil empire is clever in the extreme. And we are a nation of laws and not of men. There's no question. But the evil empire wants to change that, and they've never stopped trying since the inception of our country at our Constitutional Convention coming forward. But to know something of a group of men that has this, takes on the attitude that you're talking about, to understand the law of the land, due process, and really say, make it the supreme law of the land, I'm not aware of a group like that, no. I'm aware of groups that are just the opposite. They're very powerful. Right.
Okay, appreciate that. You know, our what we're up against is so big and so huge, and, you know, on National Liberty Alliance's front page makes it clear that only the people can save America by stepping up and standing up. But it's going to take the finger of God, finally bringing judgment upon these people and upon this nation. And I'm talking about the people behind the powers here that are really pulling the strings when I say upon this nation. Upon the people themselves, I think, is secondary. But upon the people who are controlling things, Leviathan, if I may, behind uh-huh. this whole scene. And, you know, it's going to take that. And I'm kind of putting that idea together, you know, because God changes minds, he changes hearts, he makes things happen, he makes, look at, you know, it could be one person chasing 1,000 people because of perception. Uh-huh. And God makes those things happen. We know that God has destroyed complete armies without the other side even lifting up a sword. And mm-hmm. So however God works, he works. And so it's really going to take him to do what has to be done. We know that. Mm-hmm. And it could mm-hmm. be working in the hearts of individuals. And you had made a point, you know, about the fact that people, you know, you can take an oath, but when the oath is wrong, you need to step up and do the right thing and not do mm-hmm. the wrong thing. And hopefully mm-hmm. maybe that's what's going to happen to really get the people into the courts, to get that wedge in there, so that we can finally bring this nation back to a nation of law again, whereas maybe the heart of a judge. Because let me tell you, what they have on these judges, what I suspect that they have on these judges is just unbelievable. And you can see how they can't not but do the will of their master, because that's exactly what it is. These people are their masters. They own mm-hmm. these people because they own their souls for many different reasons, and one reason in particular, which I'm not going to talk about, but things that I've been seeing for a while, but very, very strongly and powerfully most recently from coming from sources that I have a lot of respect from. And mm-hmm. So really, we're up against something that is so huge and almost impossible. And again, this is the battle, really, of God up against Satan. We're not going to be able to defeat this enemy. God needs to take this enemy down. But we, the people, can do the right thing and open the right doors and make the right decisions and be the vehicle that God may use in order to accomplish the goal, whatever goal mm-hmm. that may be, which, in my opinion, is justice, bringing justice back into our courts, bringing justice back into this nation, and thereby bringing justice potentially back into the entire world to some degree, not in a way that would be heaven on earth, of course, but bring justice back and get justice applied. So maybe it'll be the heart of a judge or a few judges that finally say, I'm not going to give in anymore. I'm going to do the right thing. And maybe therein we might get the in. So we'll keep plugging along, and maybe that'll be it. I was kind of hoping that there might be something, but I always thought that it would be too big a wish that and something that there would really, I mean, how could they hide such a thing to switch the courts in such a way? What they've done really is they've changed the laws in our courts, and they're not telling us about it. And it all stems back, from my opinion, back to the Organic Act of 1871. And I know it goes further back than that, but that's where the big crust of the problem really started. And that's where the point when they came in with this game and play on the words with our Constitution and having other things brought in that does not rest with our Bill of Rights, does not rest with our Declaration or our Constitution. Mm-hmm. But anyway, if you want to make a final comment on that, you can.
No,
not go on.
Yeah, I appreciate it. No, you've covered it well, and I've talked enough, but we'll Lord willing, talk to you again.
Okay.
Next week.
Yeah, appreciate that. What we're going to do is we're going to move right over to Gerard now, because we've been a long time, and we've had a good opportunity here a lot, and you always bring us a good word and a lot of knowledge, so thank you. Gerard, are you there? You ready to take the wheel here?
Yeah, hang on. Let me get back on my screen here. I was looking for that court, that district court, that separate court.
Yeah, the
court.
Name of it. Yeah, I think he called it an appellate court, but a court of appeals.
Federal District Court of the District of Columbia.
Right. And somebody gave us a PDF. I can't find it. But anyway, maybe we'll look into it further and get our words straight before we...
Was it you or someone else that had mentioned something about some writings from a court concerning cases here in the United States that they found appalling out in the District of Columbia? And I don't mean Washington, D.C., to the District of Columbia, but we're talking about outside in the territories.
Well, we had that woman that they convicted, and she went to Puerto Rico, and they upheld her case.
Right, yeah.
That was that custody case, and they actually did the right thing in Puerto Rico, in the federal court in Puerto Rico. And we talked like that maybe we should file some cases in that court, you know, because they seemed to uphold the law better, and I don't think there was so much politics that came in on those judges out there, you know, because that's the problem, you know. They probably don't have as quite a tight of a binding on those judges, and they felt comfortable. Well, actually, it was the jury. They allowed the jury to do their job, is what happened. And the jury said not guilty, and they overturned the judge's ruling on that. So,
yeah, I don't know that we would have any real, success by trying to go out there to come back in here, so to speak, you know. But you know what? I think we'll just pursue the path and the course that we're on, and we didn't decide to go to Oregon. Oregon made it obvious that we had to go to Oregon, and we have to go to Nevada,
well,
and we have to go to Montana. We don't have a choice. But my point is this, and then I'll let you talk. Hold on. Here's the point. The point is we got three states that we're focusing in on, three different federal districts that we're focusing in on, that we're going to make some points and deal with particular cases that we have to, you know, strongly get, and it's the crust of the whole, everything we're doing, everything we're really fighting against is found in these cases. And it goes right to Washington, D.C. But nevertheless, somewhere in this path, these doors that are open, Lord willing, God's opening a door that we're going to get to the right place and get our foot in. But again, we need to count on him. And, you know, I've gotten some messages from some people that, you know, they're not happy with the reading of the Bible. But look, this is where all law comes from. Either it's Babylon or God. And I'm going to take a stand on this. And especially, you know, when we read in the New Testament, when we mention the name of Jesus, you know, we don't necessarily have problems from Jewish people. We don't have problems from different groups of other religions, Middle East religions or anything of that nature. But we do have problems from people who, I don't know that they call them atheists, but they're just angry and they're not, they don't want that. But I want to tell you something. If we don't get up and really put God at the top of this whole thing and depend on him to win this battle, we're never going to win it. I mean, even if we dwindle our membership because of this, you know, we're not trying to force religion down anybody's throat. We're not trying to push God down anybody's throat. And we always say God has, as you understand him. You know, we read scripture today and we talked about charity. And you're going to have faith in God. You're going to have faith in Jesus Christ. You're going to have all this hope and all these and do all these marvelous things. But if you don't have that love in your heart, if you don't have that charity in your heart, the love of your fellow human being, you don't have Christ and you don't have anyone anyway. But the key to this whole thing is the right heart, creating me a new heart and create a right spirit in me. Place a right spirit in me. Creating me a new heart and renew a right spirit in me or something. I know I'm paraphrasing that. But the thing is, okay, it all starts in the heart, and that's where it goes. I mean, the thief on the cross, it was a heart change right there at the cross, right there at his death. It was a heart change that turned him to the right direction. And that's what it really takes. And people have to have the heart change. And we're taking the courts back to the law that is written in the hearts. of all men. I mean, there are individuals who are satanic. Their consciousness has been seared, and they have no consciousness. They have no empathy. You know, that's a rarity, but that's out there. But other than those people, every other men know right from wrong. The fact of what is right and what is wrong is written in our hearts. And maybe even those individuals that don't have the ability of having empathy for others and whose consciousness have totally been seared to a point where they're all sort of megalomaniacs, they're all about themselves. Maybe even they still know right from wrong. And I think they do. But it's all what's happening in the lore that God has placed in our hearts. And that's what we got to go to. And listening to Brent tonight, I mean, he brings everything right back to the core. I mean, I never realized, and I should have thought about this, to where the 12 was coming from. And it makes all the sense in the world, the 12 witnesses, to witness the witness of God, the word of God that dwelt among us, you know. And so anyway, we have to stay the course on where we're going. Pray for wisdom on the way we go and where we go and what we say. And most importantly, depend upon him to win the war, because we, on our own, without him, can't possibly do it. It's an impossibility. But all things are possible with him. But go ahead, Gerard. I'm sorry for cutting you.
Just one point I wanted to make is that particular case was in a Pennsylvania court where they were so corrupt and everybody was in bed almost literally with everybody else in her case. And they railroaded that thing. I mean, I wouldn't go in any of those courts out there in Pennsylvania. It was horrible. I mean, she ended up in Puerto Rico to get justice, but the story curl your hair about what was going on between the judge and the prosecutor and the agencies and everything that went on, and that whole thing was you can't make this stuff up. It was unbelievable. So that was disgusting, and it's definitely. I mean, look at you have. Demonic people in those courts running those things, and they're doing you know, childhood rings and all this stuff amongst themselves. It's out of control, and this is how you know they're scratching the eyeball of God. That's what's going to happen at this point, because they're going after God's children, and that's when they're going to have a problem, which is now.
And they're going after God's court, because ultimately these are supposed to be the courts of justice. We covenant with God at the Declaration of Independence, and we the people in one accord, are in agreement with this. But we've lost our way. We've become de-educated, ignorant to the law, ignorant to our spirituality, ignorant to our morality and what we should be doing. And we've lost our way. We've got to find our way back. And that's the key to our success, is finding our way back. Because, again, it's, in my humble opinion, it's becoming into the will of God. And here we are in places trying to do the right thing and making the right decisions as we go along and trying to say the right thing as best as we can in places where really bringing us right into the courts of God. This is where justice is to be found. Here in the common law courts of America, and we have satanic rituals going on by these individuals that are running our courts, and I can't even speak the words out of my mouth what I know, and concern it, because I don't want to. I can't. So anyway, you guys.
Also, just to add one thing without beating the point to death, is I read something, and I don't know if anybody else has seen. Now I'm paraphrasing it. There was a study done, and I think it was in Jefferson's time, about the 12 jurors. They had a mathematical equation that they worked out, and they said with 12 jurors, you had less than a 0.005% chance of being unjustly convicted. And then they worked it down. Every time you removed a juror, your chances went up exponentially, so that by the time you got down to 6 jurors, you're almost at a 50% chance of being wrongly convicted. And I don't know how they came up with that mathematical formula. It was pretty interesting. But it's an older study. It's not a modern-day mathematical. It's something that they knew must have something to do with the law of probabilities or however they did it. But if anybody knows anything about that, I read it once, and it would be interesting to find that information again. Anyway, I rest on that.
Okay. Well, each juror represents, I believe it's 8 and a third percent of the population, or of the people. Okay, you got the controls. Go right ahead. I might take a break for 15 or 20 minutes, but I'm going to be listening in. Go right ahead. We have to turn it into the Q&A. You want me to turn it on for you? Okay, you got it. Did you mute your mic, Gerard? Because we don't hear you. Anybody got any questions or comments? Star 6.
Star 6 and I think 1 then put you in the queue. So right now we have nobody in the queue. There we go. Well, we'll start off with California, Donaldson, if that's proper. Go ahead. You've been unmuted.
This is Jeremiah Donaldson here in California. What's up? How are you?
Oh,
hopefully
good.
All is well, you guys. I wish you all the best, okay? And everything, of course, all the best for the rest of this year and then into the new year. But, hold on, there's going to be a sound going by. It's a trash can, but some bad working. Regardless of that, I wanted to ask a question to Brent, if he's still around, or Gerard, because I thought that there was some relationship between police departments, because they work for the local government, local community, per se, the body politic, right? We the people. And the militia, you see. I thought because they had state authority, right, to basically be representing the people in the local communities, that would be considered a modern-day militia. Now, I know that from my reading, it's not necessarily the same style of receipt of a pension, but I think that it's fair to say that they've mastered the corporate art of paying out those pensions for the bounty, you know, for violation of U.S. law. So I thought maybe you could maybe like expound a little bit on Brent or Gerard or anyone for that matter.
Well, I'll tell you my opinion on it. I grew up with my parents want to support their local police department, and their philosophy was that the people had a little more control over a local police force because you elected the officials that appointed them on a town police department. And if you had a problem, you can go into the town board and it would affect these guys because that's who were writing their checks. However, I don't, you know, other than getting really warm with the sheriff, who is a constitutional, the highest law enforcement official, because he's elected by the people and he has jurisdiction in the county, the highest jurisdiction, to say that the local police department has something to do like with a militia, the two don't even come together, because your local police departments are nothing more than statutory regulation bill collectors, so to speak. It doesn't tie in for me, because that's not what they're doing, most of them. You know, years ago, we used to have, what did they call them, constables in the town, and they were in the neighborhood. And they kind of knew everybody. It was kind of like a Barney Fife thing, you know, and it was sort of harmless. And it was, you know, you had a guy in the neighborhood that helped keep the peace, and I think they called them peace officers, you know, in that respect. But I don't see a whole lot of peace officing going on today. It's, you know, basically statutory regulation, you know.
Right. And Gerard, the reason why I ask the question is because of this one fact. So many violations of the Fifth Amendment right of not self-incrimination are taking place, that if you read the Fifth Amendment, it says, except in times of public danger when the militia has been called to service. That means that your Fifth Amendment rights of non-incrimination can be suspended when the militia is called forth in time of service or in public danger, right?
Well, and when your rights are suspended when the militia's out there, it's only because the courts are not open. If the courts are open, they have to give you your constitutional rights.
Right.
If there is violence is going on and the courts can't open. Well, now you're under a type of military rule. And, you know, look at it. If they catch you doing something, they're going to put you in the stockade, and you're not going to get all the rights afforded under the Constitution, because it's impossible for them to get a jury of your peers and all this other stuff where everybody's hiding in their basements. You know what I mean? So it's a necessity type thing. And even under what they call, some people say, well, you know, we don't have a Constitution. We've been under the Labor Code since Lincoln. They never took that away. We're under martial law, blah, blah. But if you even look at the Labor Code, it says if there's no hostilities in within, I don't know what it is, 50 miles or something, they still, even during these times,
right,
they have to give you the Constitution. Well, where the heck is the Constitution?
Oh, no doubt.
It's not, but, it's not there anymore.
Actually, but they can actually, they don't have to. If you read the other provisions in the Labor Code, it says that they can decide what they want to do. They don't have to actually follow that.
That's making a rule. Here's a rule, but you don't have to follow it. Let me know how that works out. You know, but anyway, like I said, you know, they're mostly code enforcement officers, and I don't know how that would relate to the militia. You know, I feel better.
Well,
sheriffs.
I hear you, but tying in common law,
police departments.
I'm sorry. What's that?
In times of trouble, when the militias call out, I think the sheriff should have control over those local police departments, and maybe in that situation you can consider them like a militia, you know, if they were operating to uphold the people's unalienable rights and they're working on the sheriff, the elected law enforcement official, then yeah, maybe I could stretch myself to saying that they're part of the militia.
Okay, I appreciate your thoughts. My phone time is running a little bit low here, but I just want to say, I do appreciate your thoughts about that. I just want you to remember, too, that also because circumstantial evidence will lead to this inference, right, that because of state authority, that the police representing the local communities, with especially having also authority of the U.S. government, authenticated by the representation of the United States flag on the vehicle, is actually evidence of a situation where there is the military involved, okay? Because also you remember now, Gerard, that the Department of Justice has their Bureau of Prisons located in Texas. I think it's Fort Worth, Texas, on a military base, right? And so that's important. Okay, it really, really is important. And when you look at the circumstances, so many people being deprived of the right of non-self-incrimination with specific codes being passed that allow for compelled performance to have to be taken to jail, you know, and then fingerprinted or whatnot, you know. I mean, that's just, what, serious? But anyway, I just thought I'd run that by you guys. I thought maybe we were already in a place of, you know, like where the militia was called forth by the state, and we just didn't know it.
Well, I don't think anybody's going to call the militia forward, I mean, to enforce the status quo, you know what I mean? And I can't see any of the governors doing that. You know, maybe there are some out there that, you know, but you still got to have a certain amount of unrest to even claim that, you know?
Right. How deep does the fraud go? Is a good question.
The thing is when everybody realizes that you're the militia, you know, it's you, it's me, it's every
well, you,
able
we, I hear what you're saying. We can be the militia. That's what you're saying.
No, we are the militia. No. We are the militia. You have a duty under piety. You're supposed to have that weapon. If you're an American and you're a good American, you should be prepared to be a militia man. You should have a rifle.
Okay.
You should be ready to defend your country. Look, Switzerland requires it. They give you the rifle. They give you the bullets, or they used to anyway. They probably hold the bullets back now. But nevertheless, you know, it was a serious requirement, and it's mm-hmm. not that can be. We are it. We are
yeah, with
it.
All due respect, sir, I know that that's true, but there is the issue of capacity, and we don't want to just be making anyone the part of the militia. And that, I believe, is why the state is involved, as, especially when it comes to the Republican form of government that Brent was talking about earlier, guaranteed to the state. I actually have to go now, but thank you so much for taking my call. Yep.
Well, I'm gonna get the last word on this. The states do have, and they're just figureheads right now, but they should be providing for the training of, and they have certain provost marshals and things that are the head of the militia, and they're the plug-in to the state and to the governor and to the president. And every state has these because it's in their constitution. They have these officials in place. They're not doing too much right now because they don't want them to do anything, obviously. But they are there, and that's what you're talking about. You know, when do you and I decide to become a militia and we're not a mob? Well, guess what? If they're going door to door and they're burning us out, and it's like even what the ranchers did over there, you know, if they're killing people and burning houses down, you don't need to wait to be called out because you have a duty, even a duty to your fellow man at some point where you have to step in and you have to save their life. It's a no-brainer. But, you know, after that goes on for a while, eventually the militia will be called. And I don't know whether it be by the sheriff or whether they get together and they declare that this action is at the point that every able-bodied man needs to assemble. And then at that point, you know, the officers will be chosen, and whoever's in the state that is claiming that office would muster them and train them. But it's supposed to just happen naturally like that. And basically, so you're always on call and you always have a duty to you know, uphold those things. And when you see somebody getting abused or murdered or anything like that, look, you got a duty to say something. I don't know how people can stand there and do nothing. Anyway, I'm going to move to the next one. Let's see here. California. At that, Jonathan, South Carolina, I'm sorry. Oh, I lost you. Maybe I shouldn't have clicked you. Wisconsin, Randy, you've been unmuted. Go ahead.
Oh, yes, I just got a question about habeas corpus. Are you mm-hmm. using those for foreclosures, challenging jurisdiction?
No, we're not. One of the foreclosures, we're handling them a little different. We haven't done any foreclosures problems in a while, but... really, it's alerting the court and the local sheriff of the fraud that's taken place and showing them how the fraud has taken place, both of which I think is incapable of understanding, generally speaking, what's being laid out. But if they did try to understand it, they would and could. We've had actual sheriffs who said that even though they say, well, yeah, I know it's wrong, but I'm gonna uphold what the judge says. You know, we have that happening. So... the only thing we can do is that, you know, and again, there are other things maybe we might be looking into. But again, it's really getting the sheriff to work with the people, because the sheriff has to protect you. That's the person that has to stop this this crime from continuing. But no, we don't do habeas corpuses for that.
Okay, they filed for informational letter to the sheriff and all parties and everything else. And is there anything else you do, or you follow up on anything else?
Well, look,
else,
when
no?
they do, just so you know, when they do a foreclosure, no judge ever gets involved. No signature ever goes onto the paper. The whole thing is just an exercise of this plan that they have going, and they go from the one step to another step to another step to another step, and they just steamroll the process through. And so at the end, there is no judge's signature on there. There is no judge's decision. And that's true in the tax foreclosures also. It's really called a non-judicial foreclosure is what it is. And if you look up to find out if your state is a non-judicial foreclosure state, a lot of states are not. New York is not a non-judicial foreclosure state, yet they use it anyway. The IRS works under the same presumption and works the same way. and their court is an administrative court. They hold court in the federal buildings. They rent the room out, and they use federal judges. They hire the judges out, and they give them, a bonus if they get a conviction. So, I mean, that tells us something else too. And they use USC 26, and again, that's another fraud, because USC 26 even says that the USC 26 is not the law, okay? Yet they use it anyway. They call themselves a court of record, and they're not. Maybe they're a pirate's court of record, if you want to use that kind of a term. But again, there's got to be something no judge ever signs anything. Huh?
Right, but there's got to be something I can do. I mean, thing to them. I even acknowledge the warranty deed. They don't even exist that I even had the property on a lot of my properties now, because I acknowledge the warranty deed. And they just
the best you could do is make it a federal offense. They're coming at you in a foreign court, so they hijacked you into another court. You're not getting due process in this foreign court. You can only get due process in a court of record. And you can then take it to the federal court, challenging, going after them for violating your unalienable right of due process, which brings you into a proper court, and that's a way to get into the federal courts. And then you have to be able to write papers up in a way that hopefully will encourage the judge to have them throw it out, because he doesn't want to rule on these things to begin with. But when he sees that he's kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, he might make the right decision by really pushing the other side to settle with you. And just leaving you alone is enough, you know? Just going away and leaving you alone.
But they took all my properties, they're all gone. They're all gone.
Well, you want to get them back. Well, look, once we get to the other side of things, you have every right to go back to get them back. And that is, to get to the other side is to bring common law back into our court system. And to do that, only the people can do that. We have to hit critical mass, and we have to be in one accord, and we have to finally get into that courtroom, into the courts, and start getting rid of all these people that are in bad behavior through telling them to leave office because they're in bad behavior, and if they refuse to comply, then we have to have grand juries start doing indictments because they'll continue in their bad behavior. And we have to get them removed from office. And that's the only way we're going to do it. I don't know. That's the only peaceful way. So that's what we're working on doing.
Okay.
And so, if you want to get your property back, you need to get your courts back first. So it makes all the sense in the world to learn what we're doing and work with us to get a court of record back into our court system again.
Because okay, I even did a court of record in the Record State Court. It was Bill Thornton's paperwork, and they didn't care. They just railroad right through. They could care less.
Yes, they do. They don't care. You're right.
No.
All right, Gerard, back to you.
Okay. Thank you, Randy. Okay, next caller. I don't have a name. It's 6912 is the last four numbers. You've been unmuted. I think I knocked South Carolina somebody out before they didn't get back.
Hi, guys. Good night. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Yes. How you guys doing tonight? This is El Adonia, a.k.a. Gene. The question that I was having is my sister is going to a small claims court where she paid the monies off to an agency that said that she owed them, but the agency changed it. I don't know, maybe it's different owners, but the name changed, but they were saying they still had rights to the other name that the company was belonging to. So she paid them, and come to find out that no, that wasn't them for real. They had no ties with them, and they're holding her money, and they put a lien on it. Now, we was thinking about if, because she doesn't know so much about the system of court, I was wondering, is it possible that, because that's my sister, I can jump in and help her out as far as filling it out and handling that for her in small claims court?
Well, look, I don't know, small claims court.
But they only deal up to a certain amount. What's the amount?
Yeah, but they raise it up.
It's up like $1,400.
How much?
Yeah, but
it's like $1,400. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think small claims court is up to almost $5,000 now. for 45.
Yeah, but bear in mind, nobody has to go to small claims court. You can't be pushed into small claims court. That's an administrative court, and you're agreeing really to arbitration is what that is.
Yeah, but they don't know. They get a summons. You give a corporation a summons to small claims court, a lot of times it's not a bad strategy because a lot of times they'll fold. They don't want to.
Oh, yeah, you're right. They'll respond to the small claims court. Yeah, so that is one way to go. And look, you may have a good, well. Again, there's not enough money here to even get a lawyer. I mean, I don't want to tell you to get a lawyer, but you know, sometimes in certain cases, you know, there's really no government issues involved, and it's a slam dunk kind of case. You can get a lawyer who should be able to clean it up rather quickly. But if you can handle it yourself, you file your own paperwork, of course. You can come in. They won't recognize it as next friend because, again, it's an administrative court system. So they may not recognize the federal rule of the next friend.
I'm her brother. I'm her brother.
Yeah, but you call friend. It doesn't
I can't
matter.
Take over, though, right? No.
No, you can look at. You can help her file paperwork. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very much more lackadaisical in small claims court. You know, if you're nice and polite, the judge will let you get away with a lot of stuff that you can't get away with a regular court. But what court did it go through to begin with? Did it go to a court to begin with?
They took her to court saying she owed some money, so she paid the company off and come to find out that company
had. What court did they file that in to get her moving in the first place? What court was it? Was it a state court or a local court?
No, it wasn't state court. It's like, small claims court, like county court, stuff like that.
It's not small claims, though. It was county court, some business. Look, I would put a complaint in with them, too. You got to let
a complaint?
A complaint, yeah. You say, look at this.
Yeah, but doesn't the county court run small claims also?
Well, yeah. It's under, John, it's all under the unified court system. So the small claims court is your town court, which is basically under the auspices of the county, who is really an arm of the state.
Okay, so that means she would continue on with the small claims court and then also she would file a complaint?
You could file the small claims. I would definitely do that because it's a pain in the neck for those people. But I also, at the same time, go into the court and find out where you complain about somebody using fraud. They're claiming that they had a relationship that they didn't. That's fraud on the court. You make a complaint. They got to have somebody there to take complaints and say, look, this case was decided through a lie, through perjury. And fraud on the court.
Yeah, fraud on the court. There you go.
The judge might actually look at it and decide that he doesn't want that headache in his court. Look, there's a lot of fly-by-night companies, and if you don't make a complaint, the judges don't know. If that name comes up and it keeps coming up, sometimes they ban them from their courts. I had a company chasing me that the guy said, these guys are so bad, they should be deported. You know? That slimy, you know. So I would make a complaint anyway because, look, in life, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. If you don't complain, you got no chance of getting anything, right? So at least complain. And make the complaint and file the small claims, and maybe doing those two things, you might shake something loose. You know what I mean?
Okay.
I mean, that's the best advice I can give you.
Thanks for that information there.
Okay.
I appreciate that. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Next question. Looks like Michigan Don. You've been unmuted.
Hey, Gerard. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Good. Hey, I was just going to chime in on that, the discussion a little bit earlier on the militia there. You're absolutely right. The militia is all of us, but it is every able-bodied person. So maybe that person that was talking has some physical limitation and he was worried about being drafted or something and he can't fight. But it is every able-bodied position. But as far as every able-bodied person, but as far as who's going to call the militia forth, I don't know how close you are to that whole environment, but they're ready. I mean, the different militias that are out there and people that I know that are in them, if the situation arises where, you know, they are needed to come into play, they're not going to wait for a phone call. Most of them right now are trying to get next to. I know one of the things that we're in the Oath Keepers, we're not a militia, but what you know we are doing is trying to communicate with our sheriffs and police and EMS and fire and so forth, and we're letting them know, hey, we're here. We're going to show up as a help if, you know, things get out of hand and we see that you people are being overrun, then, you know, that's one of the missions of the Oath Keepers is to go and assist all governmental first responders. But, is you know, as far as wondering who's going to call the militia and how are they going to be called, that's not even a question because they're training constantly. They're picking up new skills. They're growing. And, you know, they're just waiting until that time comes that they're needed, and they're going to be there. So we don't need anybody to call out the militia. They are going to come forth. Now, you are correct that some states, like the state of Michigan, does have a state militia. And it's not the National Guard. It is a militia. And they accept people from, I think it's 18 years old to 65, even, as far as age goes. And there is a group like that. I would not have any inclination to be any part of that group because you don't know which way that group's going to end up going. You know, you don't know if they're going to end up fighting for the cabal or if they're going to be fighting for the people. But so I would focus on the unorganized militias, of which there are many, and they've been growing at a very, very rapid pace during these last 5 years, well, really since Obama took office. That he not only was the greatest gun salesman in the world, but he was the greatest militia recruiter in the world. And
well,
so,
and you're right. And the thing is I think the one of the things that has changed in this country is people are not looking at the militia as some kind of radical idea so much anymore. They're kind of warming up to the idea that hey, government is a force like fire, and sometimes it goes against us. And they're starting to understand that. And thinking little things like what they did in Katrina when they tried to take the people's guns, that was a big, big blow to the New World Order because people saw that, people stood up against that. They were sick, you know, it really made a big, you know, it was the bombing of the Murr building, which I believe was a false flag. They set them guys up because they wanted to vilify the militia back then. They were trying to take the militia out before 9/11. It was all part of their plan. And I think what's happened, the different situations that have happened, like Katrina and these different other ones that have happened, what they're doing is they're putting a chink, they're making chinks in the government's armor. And I also think it's the other thing that has held them back so far. I think they would have already put us under martial law, but they just don't know what the force is, and they realize that they're not going to be able to do things so easily. You know, I hate to see the day that happens because, look, at any liberty we lose, we'll never get back. It's going to be very, you know what I mean? To me, if the militia has to come in and do something, I don't know that it'll be a temporary operation. I see the balkanization of America. I see, you know, certain states will be free states and other ones will be. I see 100 years war, okay? So
at least 20 to 25 anyways.
and the thing is, I don't know. Look, that's why we're doing what we're doing, because we're not willing to even have that. We want the whole enchilada. We want our freedoms, and we want them the way that we're supposed to have them. And we can actually do it. And it's a matter of education, and it's a matter of lighting the brush fire in those tireless people's minds, because that's what our forefathers did. And look, it only takes a small percentage. You know, you got 5% of the people on one side, 5% on the other side, and everybody else is just kind of like going along to get along, and that's just the way it is. So, you know, I mean, you can even a 3% group that works together is enough to make a change in a country, because most people, 97% of the people aren't doing anything. They're not helping the situation. They're not hurting the situation. They're just bumps on the log, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
So, you know, and the other thing people need to realize is that the tyranny we have today, we bring on ourselves because it's self-policing. We cooperate with it, and that's why it works. The day we stop cooperating with it, it's Dorothy, click your heels, and you'll go home. Because the only reason it works is because they got us believing that it works. It's mostly smoke and mirrors. If everybody said enough, look at you could have a revolution in this country, and you could have it overnight. And all you have to do is get everybody that gets a traffic ticket, plead innocent, and say, I want a trial, and I want a jury trial, which shut them down. The reason they got you going in those rooms, you plead innocent, and then they plea bargain, give me $150, we'll write your speeding ticket down to a parking on the pavement, because it's a revenue thing.
Well, one of the things that, and you talked about it just a minute ago, and that is engaging more people. Just like with anything else, the people need a hero. Even Stuart Rhodes believes in, and John, you were in a texting conversation with me and him, and Gerard, I think maybe you were involved too, but, you know, Stuart Rhodes still thinks that that NLA is a bunch of tinfoil hat wearers. This Oregon thing, I mean, if we can break this Oregon thing and even make half of the progress that we're trying to make, it's going to be all over the place, because the whole Oregon thing is so much in the spotlight. And now, you know, I don't know if you guys were aware, but they're starting to actually prosecute some of the people that were involved down at Bundy, and I shook my head the other day. I was reading about Jerry DeLamis and one of the big militia guys, I can't remember his name, but they took plea bargains and they accepted felonies on their records to avoid 20 other felonies that they wanted to add. But so the whole nation, they still all have their eyes on this. And if NLA can accomplish half of what they're trying to do, it's going to get out there. And people are going to scratch their heads, and they're going to sit up and pay attention. So, you know, hopefully we can break that, and that'll help break through some of what is out there that I'm saying is just fear-oriented. You know, you said people are going to have to start taking responsibility, and they're going to have to stand up. Well, they're scared, and because they don't believe it's true. They're not educated. And, you know, that's why it'll be so big if NLA can accomplish half of what they're trying to do in Oregon, because that'll open up a lot of eyes and maybe even Stuart Rhodes to see that it is true and we do know what we're talking about and it is the way that it's supposed to work. So, you know, God bless NLA on what they're doing there, and hopefully we can accomplish something big.
Well, Stuart Rhodes has a big impediment, and the impediment is that he's a Harvard-trained lawyer. That's a
big... His impediment is his law degree.
Exactly. It's the worst thing going. I mean, it's like they got them so locked down in their thought process. They just, you know, freedom does not compute. You know, they're looking for their statute to hang their hat on and all this other stuff. And they've just been trained to think a certain way. And look at the lawyers that can think free are kind of like, I've met people that are mechanically inclined, and I met people that are very book smart. Very rarely do you get a guy that's very book smart and mechanically inclined, and usually those people are you know, they're like geniuses. They can do anything. And so, you know, you get stuck in the book smart thing, and then you don't have the practical. You can't put it in a practical sense. You know what I'm saying?
Just on that very subject, when I was going through college and also talking to people in industry, you know, it's an age-old adage that says that those who can do and those who can't teach.
That's right.
And so the book smart guy who's mechanically inclined is a real needle in a haystack. And what we need to rely on is the people that are mechanically inclined to become willing to become doers and stand up and fight the battle and turn things around.
Yeah, you're 100% right that people need heroes and leaders. Look, I've seen it happen in the local courts. We had a guy that went in there and he gave the judge a run for his money. The judge couldn't answer him. He was doing constitutional stuff, and he was firing the attorney that the judge tried to give him. He was just giving him a lot of trouble. And the next guy up, he says, and he leaves the court. I don't remember what the conclusion was, but he walks out, and the next guy goes, I want what he said. Oh, and you know what they did to us after that? They never let us come into a courtroom where they scheduled our stuff separately from everybody else's, which is illegal, by the way, because it's supposed to be a public forum. They shouldn't be scheduling you from where nobody else is. And that's where you got to get court watchers and people to come in, because they don't operate good in the light, only in the dark. But they couldn't have.
Yeah, but remember, they're administrative courts, and so they do whatever they please. They're not real courts, although they do fine and they do incarcerate, but they really don't have that power. But they'll tell you themselves that they don't abide by the Constitution. They can't. They're applying statutes.
Yeah, and if you know what you're talking about, and they can't answer you, and you're up there making these claims, and the judge is not giving you good answers, and it's obvious that the judge doesn't know, what he's talking about, or that he's obviously not giving you your due process, it looks bad for him, and he's losing the decor of the courtroom with you up there claiming all this stuff and making him look bad,
Right, exactly.
I don't know if you've ever seen that little video we had about traffic court. When you go in, the things to say in traffic court about, to the judge to get released and ask him what jurisdiction it is. But, it's a pretty cool little skit. I think it's still on our website there. I forget what it's called.
I saw it a long time ago.
Yeah, we have that. And, that's a pretty cool little thing. If you can get away with it, it's pretty good. You know what I mean? It gives you something to say that they're going to get stuck answering, on an answer. Mm-hmm. They're going to have problem answering it. And the other thing is we did have, I think it was Carl Lentz is the guy that had a couple of videos, and he called them get out of jail free card. And he had a couple of really good methods for getting yourself out of the court to begin with all this pretrial stuff. You see, when you're standing there sticking your foot in your mouth, that's when you get in trouble, especially if you're not good at articulating and you want to hold your jurisdiction and you don't want to go into any strange, courts. So if you can get out of there, he has an excuse. I need to seek counsel. They love to hear that. And that gets you out of the court so that you can go and file a paper, and then you can fight the thing on paper. If you can keep yourself from standing in front of this guy who doesn't have jurisdiction or authority in the first place, you're much better off if you do it on paper. And you can even bring it into a higher court, which they don't like that. They don't understand that. And that just completely blows their world up. And I think that's why there was somebody came on and they said in their community that NLA had a reputation that they told the cops, if you're stopping anybody and they're with this NLA group, don't give them any kind of a ticket that will bring them into court. Because I guess we had enough people mucking up their works. And somebody probably said, I don't care whether you agree with them or you don't agree with them, but you're losing a lot of money and wasting a lot of time with these guys. Just don't get them in here to begin with, because they're messing up our good money scheme. You know what I mean? I mean, think about it. If they got to have you come back 20 times because you're a burr under their saddle, they're not making the money that they make just by everybody going in the back room and paying their money. That's what they want,
Right, right, exactly.
So look at that. That is a good chance to take the country back, too. If everybody went in their local courts and started fighting, like you see these videos from England, because they're very steeped in the common law there, and they let them talk in those lower courts more than they do here. The judges aren't so, doesn't seem to me like they're so willing to put people in contempt of court, and something through their process, some of them, it seems that they let them speak in the court. And when everybody's there listening, you see some good victories in there anyway,
This one gentleman was telling me he had a traffic court hearing and he went in there, and before his proceedings start, he said, "Your Honor, before we start, I want to ask you a question. Are you in the de facto or are you de jure?" And the judge stood up and walked out.
Maybe he had to go to the bathroom real bad. So
he didn't want anything to do with this guy. And the guy said the judge has left the courtroom and he walked out.
Yeah, well, if he walks out that, and then he walks back in, you have to do it again. There's some kind of game they play with that. I'm not quite sure how that works. But it's like it starts over, and you have to repeat your question. You have to open your quarter record up again. Or when he walks out, you say the judge has abandoned the bench, and I rule on the case. I'm the sovereign of the court. Case dismissed. Right?
Right. Yep, done. That's right.
I've heard that. I've never heard him coming back with that. But anyway, we got 1 minute. Let me go get David. Maybe we got another question. I'm going to let you go. We beat this thing down to death, okay?
Okay, good enough, Trent.
Thanks, yeah. Go ahead, David.
Hey, everybody. How you doing? I know a guy who was down in Florida 3 years ago on vacation with his wife, and they went out, had a few drinks. He got pulled over for 8 miles over the speed limit, and they gave him a DUI, put him in jail down there, and down in, I think it's Clearwater. And he bailed out. Him and his wife came back up to Pennsylvania, and he got at the time he didn't have much money, so he got a court-appointed lawyer. Everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. He got a court-appointed lawyer, and she said that she would handle the case. I can't remember the term that my brother told me. It was my brother. But where she would handle the female lawyer would handle the case from out of state. You know, she would present before the judge the case and explain that.
I'm trying to ex parte hearing or something like
right.
that.
Yeah, something like that. So, anyway, long story short, she went on maternity leave and forgot about him. And so they put a warrant out because he didn't show up for court. Well, they figured he was supposed to show up because she never put that through. So they figured he was supposed to show up for court physically. Well, they put the warrant out for him, not knowing the situation. Well, he found this out and basically went ballistic and to try to figure out what he could do about it. Well, they said there's nothing that he could do about it. So he got some money going, and he hired a lawyer and borrowed some money, hired a lawyer, and this lawyer basically took $5,000 and did nothing from a distance, remote ripoff, so to speak.
Yeah, well,
and
most of them do, but we'll run it out of time. So you know,
okay.
Can you wind it up?
Yeah. Long story short, this he still has a warrant after 3.5 years, and the DA says the best thing you can do is come down and face the music and take it from there. So. What do you suggest that he does?
Well, that's a good one. I couldn't even tell you off here in less than a minute. If I could do that, I should be a millionaire. There's things he can do. He's going to have to file paperwork and stuff. Look at, are they going to extradite him for this? They haven't yet. What are they?
Well,
waiting
no,
for?
They
you,
say
you could look into statutes of limitations also. But look at if they can't extradite him. Just be careful. Don't drive in the neighborhood, you know?
Yeah. Well, the police, he said the police said that he, they know it's there, but they can't pick him up because they haven't brought it past that point of, you know, jurisdiction, I guess.
Yeah, but they don't have jurisdiction anyway, probably.
Well, some states do cooperate.
I know. Well, I know.
That state pick you up and hold you, but then they got to come get you and bring you down, and somebody's got to pay for that. Don't forget, this whole thing's about money, and on a stupid DWI case, especially if it was his first one, there ain't that much money there. I mean, maybe they'll get a jail sentence out of it. I don't know, but obviously, it's not that important if they let him go 3 years, and there is going to be a statute of limitations at some point. I mean, look.
You
at
mean where it run out? You would say.
Yeah, he answered.
Yeah, I'd look, if it's been 3.5 years, I'd look to see if there's statute of limitation on whatever's going down at them.
He answered the charge. He hired a lawyer. You know, I mean, that's kind of, look, you got a public defender. That's all their whole system that fell down. I would be indicting their system about How can you let somebody say they're going to handle it remotely and then go on maternity leave and not call me and not give me anybody else and not have any communication with the court? What is these people you're hiring as public pretenders?
Well, you said the cop told him, the PA cop told him that if they wanted to pursue it, they would try to, you know, push it forward if it sits too long. But I don't know if this cop really knows what he's talking about. So.
All right, well, look, with that, we're going to end it. We've come way beyond our time. We're 5 minutes over, so.
All right.
Okay, sorry. All right, thanks everybody for participating tonight. And Lord willing, we'll see you by next Monday. And again, Thursday, we'll be getting together for organizing and pushing things through the nation. We've got to get these committees of safeties up and moving everywhere. They're extremely important, and we've got to get communications going. Okay, with that, have a good evening. Godspeed. See you next time.